You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, I'm going to tell you some stories that I have been collecting. You can read them at worldbeyondwar.org/war stories. Here's the first one, called Have Some Blankets and Die. Jeffrey Amherst, commanding general of British forces in North America and later a lord, and a man for whom Amherst, Massachusetts is named, wrote this in a letter to a subordinate. Could it not be contrived to send the smallpox among those disaffected tribes of Indians? We must, on this occasion, use every stratagem in our power to reduce them. Beyond smallpox, Amherst proposed, quote, to try every other method that can serve to extirpate this execrable race. He asked that, quote, measures be taken as would bring about the total extirpation of those Indian nations. He hoped to, quote, put a most effectual stop to their very being. His plans were acted upon using infected blankets and handkerchiefs. Total extirpation was not achieved. Hundreds of years later, it remains common for members of the U.S. military to describe invaded lands as, quote, Indian country. In 2017, President Donald Trump proposed total destruction, and Senator John McCain proposed extermination for North Korea. This one is called Nobody Had Yet Thought of a Better Way Except Those Who Had. From 1683 to 1755, Pennsylvania's European settlers had no major wars with the native nations, in stark contrast with other British colonies. Pennsylvania had slavery, it had capital and other horrific punishments, and it had individual violence, but it chose not to use war, not to take land without what was supposed to be just compensation, and not to push alcohol on the native people in the way that opium was later pushed on China and guns and planes are now pushed on nasty despots. In 1710, the Tuscaroras from North Carolina sent messengers to Pennsylvania asking for permission to settle there. All the money that would have been used for militias, forts, and armaments in Pennsylvania was available, for better or worse, to build Philadelphia, remember what its name means, and to develop the colony. The colony had 4,000 people within 3 years, and by 1776, Philadelphia surpassed Boston and New York in size. So while the superpowers of the day were battling for control of the continent, one group of people rejected the idea that war is necessary and prospered more rapidly than any of their neighbors who insisted it was. Thank you to John Rohr for this story. Lighting a match. It was March 23, 1775, and a wealthy white man who owned many people as slaves was giving a speech in a church in Richmond, Virginia. What he said was not recorded, but we know that he spoke poorly of rule by England. An account just the next week by a man who had attended the speech tells us that the speaker called King George III, quote, a tyrant, a fool, a puppet, and a tool. This order may have merely hinted at revolution, as on other occasions, or he may have openly advocated it. He also probably spoke on this day, as he did on others before and after, of the need to militarily suppress slave revolts and to resist any British efforts to free people from slavery, as well as of the need to attack Native Americans to the west, where this man was making a fortune on land speculation. 42 years later, a supposed text of the speech was published, having been concocted from decades-old memories solicited second-hand, plus sheer invention. The original speaker had long since died, but now we learned that he had spoken against a metaphorical enslavement to England, and possibly even acted out liberating himself from invisible bondage. Words put into his mouth included these, I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. There is no record of Patrick Henry subsequently risking death. He saw no combat action. He did, however, campaign against ratification of the U.S. Constitution. His rallying cry, popularizing a war, theretofore desired mostly by elites, is sufficient, however, to rank him as a heroic founding father of a sort that people in Canada and Australia must deeply regret lacking. Thank you to Ray Raphael for this story. This one is called, Was That the Rubicon? The native people of his country called him Konotokarius, meaning town destroyer. He was the wealthiest man on his continent, and he ruled fiercely over his fighters. Those who misbehaved were often given 100 lashes with a whip. Conotocarius tried to increase the punishment to 500 lashes. He led a desperate insurgency against the legitimate government, and a turning point came with the crossing of a river. It was Christmas night when he sneaked his fighters across a wide river and marched them on a sleepy camp of government mercenaries. The insurgents, or what the U.S. State Department would today call terrorists, killed 22, wounded 83, and took about 900 prisoners, as well as seizing their supplies. The attacker's own losses were 5 wounded and 0 dead in the battle, though 2 died from exposure to the cold during the march. Among the group of freedom fighters, or terrorists, choose your term, but apply it also to resistors in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, Niger, Philippines, etc., were James Madison, James Monroe, John Marshall, Aaron Burr, Alexander Hamilton, and their leader, whose other name was George Washington. 235 years later, a giant triumphalist phallic monument to Washington cracked in an earthquake, possibly caused by fracking. While the regime established in that Delaware River crossing war long ago waged wars in several different places around the globe, maintaining a troop presence in 175 countries. This one is called Compensated Emancipation. At the end of the 1700s, the world was dominated by slavery. Slavery was the norm. The vast majority of people on earth were in slavery or serfdom. Before the end of the 1800s, slavery had been outlawed almost everywhere and drastically reduced in its actual presence. Most parts of the world that ended or took steps to virtually end slavery and the slave trade did so without civil wars, driven forward by a nonviolent abolitionist movement and some violent slave revolts. The United States dramatically reduced slavery at the cost of 750,000 dead, cities burned, militarism glorified, and seemingly eternal resentment fostered. To suggest that another course was possible is typically met with the facts of how dramatically differently people would have had to think and behave. In other words, an underestimation of the term possible. Incredibly difficult, though it was to enact, there was someone who had an idea. From 1856 to 1860, Elihu Burritt promoted a plan to prevent civil war through compensated emancipation, or the purchase and liberation of enslaved people by the government, an example that the English had set in the West Indies, and an approach that would be used in Washington, D.C., but not the rest of the United States, in 1862. Burritt traveled constantly all over the country speaking. He organized a mass convention that was held in Cleveland. He lined up prominent supporters. He edited newsletters. On June 20th, 2013, The Atlantic published an article called "No, Lincoln Could Not Have Bought the Slaves." Why not? Well, the slave owners didn't want to sell. That's perfectly true. They didn't. Not at all. But The Atlantic focuses on another argument, namely that it would have been too expensive, costing as much as $3 billion in 1860s money. Yet if you read closely, it's easy to miss it. The author admits that the war cost over twice that much. The cost of freeing people was simply unaffordable, yet the cost over twice as much of killing people goes by almost unnoticed, as if it were a current Pentagon budget. The Brooks Brothers Aryan. A very popular and famous promoter of wars for the Aryan race had his war costume designed especially for him by Brooks Brothers. In his worldview, the Aryans had come from the Middle East to Germany and from there to England in the form of the Anglo-Saxons, who had moved westward across North America and on to the Pacific, from which they would come full circle to the eventual, and still longed for, conquering of what is now called Iran. In a 1910 lecture at Oxford, this well-dressed Aryan argued in favor of ethnic conquest, claiming that allowing members of conquered peoples to live was slowing the progress of the race. His name was Teddy Roosevelt. The Yankees of the Far East. In 1614, Japan had cut itself off from the West. resulting in centuries of relative peace and prosperity and the blossoming of Japanese art and culture. In 1853, the U.S. Navy had forced Japan open to U.S. merchants, missionaries, and militarism. The Japanese studied the Americans' racism and adopted a strategy to deal with it. They sought to westernize themselves and present themselves as a separate race superior to the rest of the Asians. They became honorary Aryans. Lacking a single god or a god of conquest, they invented a divine emperor, borrowing heavily from Christian tradition. They dressed and dined like Americans and sent their students to study in the United States. The Japanese were often referred to in the United States as the Yankees of the Far East. In 1872, the U.S. military began training the Japanese in how to conquer other nations with an eye on Taiwan. Charles Legendre proposed a Monroe Doctrine for Asia. That is, a Japanese policy of dominating Asia in the way that the United States dominated its hemisphere. Japan established a Bureau of Savage Affairs and invented new words like koroni, colony. Talk in Japan began to focus on the responsibility of the Japanese to civilize the savages. In 1873, Japan invaded Taiwan with U.S. military advisors, and Korea was next. It's all Korea's fault. Korea and Japan had known nothing but peace for centuries. When the Japanese arrived in U.S. ships, wearing U.S. clothing, talking about their divine emperor, and proposing a treaty of friendship, the Koreans thought the Japanese had lost their minds and told them to get lost, knowing that China was there at Korea's back. But the Japanese talked China into allowing Korea to sign the treaty without explaining to either the Chinese or Koreans what the treaty meant in its English translation. In 1894, Japan declared war on China, a war in which U.S. weapons carried the day. China gave up Taiwan and the Liaodong Peninsula, paid a large indemnity, declared Korea independent, and gave Japan the same commercial rights in China that the U.S. and European nations had. Japan was triumphant, until China persuaded Russia, France, and Germany to oppose Japanese ownership of Liaodong. Japan gave it up, and Russia grabbed it. Japan felt betrayed by white Christians. In 1904, President Teddy Roosevelt was pleased with a Japanese surprise attack on Russian ships. As the Japanese again waged war on Asia as honorary Aryans, Roosevelt secretly and unconstitutionally cut deals with them, approving a Monroe Doctrine for Japan in Asia and handing Japan Korea as a koroni. Yet, Roosevelt backed Russia's refusal to pay Japan a dime, and he refused to make his Monroe Doctrine for Japan public. Japan began to deeply resent its mentor. Thank you to James Bradley for this story. To hell with Spain. Remember the Maine and to hell with Spain. That was the cry of the yellow journalists of 1898 who blamed an explosion and sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor on the Spanish. Spain proposed that the dispute over what caused the explosion in or near the ship be sent to a third party for arbitration. Spain committed to abiding by any decision and to making any amends required. To hell with that. The U.S. government preferred to go to war, a war on Cuba, the Philippines, and various Pacific islands. Today, the USS Maine is as widely dispersed as a medieval saint, with one mast on display as a monument in Arlington, Virginia, and another at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, plus anchors from the ship displayed in Virginia, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, two of them, and Maine, as well as guns, propellers, other parts, and plaques made from melting the ship down, now on display in at least 84 other locations around the United States. It is not known whether touching these relics aids one in believing the marketing for the most recent wars. Freeing the Philippines. More Filipinos died in the first day of fighting off their U.S. benefactors than Americans would die storming the beaches at Normandy. In the days that followed, many Filipinos were discovered to be in need of waterboarding. U.S. troops in the Philippines sang a pleasant little song about providing the water torture to the Filipinos. Here's a verse. Oh, pump it in him till he swells like a toy balloon. The fool pretends that liberty is not a precious boon, but we'll contrive to make him see the beauty of it soon, shouting the battle cry of freedom. How could that fail to work? Sunken ships loosen lips. Germany sank the Lusitania. A horrible act of mass murder. The Lusitania had been loaded up with weapons and troops for the British. Another horrible act of mass murder. But most damaging were the lies told about it all. Germany had published warnings in New York newspapers and newspapers around the United States. These warnings had been printed right next to ads for sailing on the Lusitania and had been signed by the German embassy. Newspapers had written articles about the warnings. The Cunard Company had been asked about the warnings. The former captain of the Lusitania had already quit, reportedly due to the stress of sailing through what Germany had publicly declared a war zone. Meanwhile, Winston Churchill is quoted as having said, "It is most important to attract neutral shipping to our shores in the hope especially of embroiling the United States with Germany." It was under his command that the usual British military protection was not provided to the Lusitania, despite Cunard having stated that it was counting on that protection. U.S. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan resigned over the U.S. failure to remain neutral. That the Lusitania was carrying weapons and troops to aid the British in the war against Germany was asserted by Germany and by other observers, and was true. Yet the U.S. government said then, and U.S. textbooks say now, that the innocent Lusitania was attacked without warning, an action alleged to justify entering a war. Wait just a minute. Exactly at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, people across Europe suddenly stopped shooting guns at each other. Up until that moment, they were killing and taking bullets, falling and screaming, moaning and dying. Then they stopped, on schedule. It wasn't that they'd gotten tired or come to their senses. Both before and after 11 o'clock, they were simply following orders. The armistice agreement that ended World War I had set 11 o'clock as quitting time. Henry Nicholas John Gunther had been born in Baltimore, Maryland, to parents who had immigrated from Germany. In September 1917, he had been drafted to help kill Germans. When he'd written home from Europe to describe how horrible the war was and to encourage others to avoid being drafted, he'd been demoted and his letter censored. He had told his buddies he would prove himself. At 5 a.m. on 11/11/1918, the armistice was signed. As the deadline of 11 a.m. approached, Henry got up against orders and bravely charged with his bayonet toward two German machine guns. The Germans were aware of the armistice and tried to wave him off. He kept approaching and shooting. When he got close, a short burst of machine gun fire ended his life at 10:59 a.m. Henry was the last of the 11,000 men to be killed or wounded between the signing of the armistice and its taking effect. Henry Gunther was given his rank back, but not his life. Armistice Day. Each year, for a lot of years, there was a remembrance on November 11th. The U.S. Congress called Armistice Day a holiday to, quote, perpetuate peace through goodwill and mutual understanding between nations, a day dedicated to the cause of world peace. When church bells rang their bells at 11 o'clock, that was what they meant. It was a holiday for peace, and it lasted as long as the idea of peace did. Outlawing war. A lawyer in Chicago named Salmon Levinson had an idea. If you could ban dueling, why couldn't you ban war? He built a popular movement that did just that. Until 1928, war was legal. Its outlawing, by means of all the wealthiest nations on earth signing and ratifying the Kellogg-Briand Pact, was the biggest news story of 1928. Wars were prevented. After World War II, the losers were prosecuted for the new crime. Wealthy nations never went to war with each other again. Conquest and colonialism virtually ceased. Territorial gains through war were restored to 1928 borders. The number of nations on Earth quickly doubled as it became relatively safe to exist as a small country. But the outlawing of war was never accompanied by disarming of weapons. In fact, the arming and funding of future enemies became a growing industry from that day to this. The law was twisted at Nuremberg and Tokyo and in the United Nations Charter into a ban only on aggressive and non-UN-authorized wars. The five biggest weapons dealers and war makers were given veto power in the Security Council. Endless rules were invented for proper wars. The idea that war was a crime was intentionally forgotten. If anyone mentions it nowadays, the response is that war exists and is therefore not a crime. A response that seems to work only in this instance, and not for any other crimes, all of which exist or there would be no point in criminalizing them. The Great Depression, or Preparation by Mule. In the 1930s, the U.S. military expanded into the Pacific. In March 1935, President Franklin Roosevelt bestowed Wake Island on the U.S. Navy and gave Pan Am Airways a permit to build runways on Wake Island, Midway Island, and Guam. Japanese military commanders announced that they were disturbed and viewed these runways as a threat. So did peace activists in the United States. By the next month, Roosevelt had planned war games and maneuvers near the Aleutian Islands and Midway Island. By the following month, peace activists were marching in New York advocating friendship with Japan. Norman Thomas wrote in 1935, quote, "The man from Mars who saw how men suffered in the last war and how frantically they are preparing for the next war, which they know will be worse, would come to the conclusion that he was looking at the denizens of a lunatic asylum." The U.S. believed a Japanese attack on Hawaii would begin with conquering the island of Niihau, from which flights would take off to assault the other islands. U.S. Army Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel Gerald Brandt approached the Robinson family, which owned Niihau and still does. He asked them to plow furrows across the island in a grid to render it useless for airplanes. Between 1933 and 1937, three Niihau men cut the furrows with plows pulled by mules or draft horses. The U.S. Navy spent the next few years working up plans for war with Japan. The March 8, 1939 version of which described, quote, "an offensive war of long duration." As it turned out, the Japanese had no plans to use Niihau, but when a Japanese plane that had just been part of the attack on Pearl Harbor had to make an emergency landing, it landed on Niihau, despite all the efforts of the mules and horses. Peace versus Holocaust. Jesse Wallace Hewen, founder of the War Resisters League, was very concerned in 1942 by stories of Nazi plans, no longer focused on expelling Jews, but turning toward plans to murder them. Hewen believed that such a development appeared, quote, "natural from their pathological point of view," and that it might really be acted upon if World War II continued. Quote, "It seems that the only way to save thousands and perhaps millions of European Jews from destruction," she wrote, "would be for our government to broadcast the promise of an armistice on condition that the European minorities are not molested any further. It would be very terrible if 6 months from now we should find that this threat has literally come to pass without our making even a gesture to prevent it," end quote. When her predictions were fulfilled only too well by 1943, she wrote to the U.S. State Department and the New York Times, quote, "2 million Jews have already died, and 2 million more will be killed by the end of the war." She warned that military successes against Germany would just result in further scapegoating of Jews. Quote, "Victory will not save them, for dead men cannot be liberated," she wrote. Thank you to Lawrence Whitner for this story. Let's try to stay focused. Quote, "Anthony Eden, Britain's foreign secretary, who'd been tasked by Churchill with handling queries about refugees, dealt coldly with one of many important delegations, saying that any diplomatic effort to obtain the release of the Jews from Hitler was fantastically impossible. On a trip to the United States, Eden candidly told Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, that the real difficulty with asking Hitler for the Jews was that, quote, Hitler might well take us up on any such offer, and there simply are not enough ships and means of transportation in the world to handle them. Churchill agreed, quote, even were we to obtain permission to withdraw all the Jews, he wrote in reply to one pleading letter, transport alone presents a problem which will be difficult of solution. Not enough shipping and transport. 2 years earlier, the British had evacuated nearly 340,000 men from the beaches of Dunkirk in just 9 days. The U.S. Air Force and many thousands of new planes. During even a brief armistice, the Allies could have airlifted and transported refugees in very large numbers out of the German sphere. End quote. Thank you to and quoted from Nicholson Baker. Anne Frank's visa application. A ship of Jewish refugees from Germany was chased away from Miami by the Coast Guard. The U.S. and other nations refused to accept most Jewish refugees, and the majority of the U.S. public supported that position. The U.S. engaged in no diplomatic or military effort to save the victims of the Nazi concentration camps. Anne Frank's family was denied U.S. visas. Kyoto's survival. U.S. Secretary of War Henry Stimson kept Kyoto off the list of targets for nuclear bombs. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not more military or less civilian than Kyoto was, and they were considered less ideal locations to demonstrate the new bombs. But Kyoto had cultural significance, and it appears that among those who appreciated Kyoto's beauty was Henry Stimson, who had visited Kyoto. As far as we know, he had never been to Hiroshima or Nagasaki, which was too bad for them. Why are there two Koreas? Following World War II, two American colonels after midnight on August 11, 1945, pulled out a National Geographic map and picked a place as far north as they thought they could get away with. They chose the 38th parallel of latitude. They drew a line. They thereby doubled the number of Koreas in the world. The North stopped receiving food from the South, and the South stopped receiving electricity from the North. The North got a leader chosen by the Soviet Union, and the South got one chosen by and imported from Washington, D.C. What could go wrong? Can you wash a brain? During and after the Korean War of 1950-53, the United States had a problem for which the solution was brainwashing. Not actual brainwashing, but the creation and popularization of the concept of brainwashing. It became very useful to spread about the idea that the Chinese were capable of things that the CIA only dreamed of and desperately searched for, such as the creation of Manchurian candidates, human beings programmed like machines. In particular, it became necessary to convince people that the Chinese could erase someone's mind and replace it with a bunch of made-up stories that would be sincerely believed. This feat, which is not actually possible in the real world, was called brainwashing. But why was it needed? Well, U.S. troops who had been held as prisoners during the war had said some pretty terrible things about the crimes they had been engaged in, and now they were free and back home and refusing to recant their testimony. During the Korean War, the United States bombed virtually all of North Korea and a good bit of the South, killing millions of people. It dropped massive quantities of napalm. It bombed dams, bridges, villages, houses. This was all-out mass slaughter. But there was something the U.S. government didn't want known, something deemed unethical in this genocidal madness. We now know that the United States dropped on China and North Korea insects and feathers carrying anthrax, cholera, encephalitis, and bubonic plague. This was supposed to be a secret at the time, and the Chinese response of mass vaccinations and insect eradication probably contributed to the project's general failure. Hundreds were killed, but not millions. But members of the U.S. military, taken prisoner by the Chinese, confessed to what they had been a part of, and confessed publicly when they got back to the United States. It was quickly discovered, to everyone's great relief, that these poor souls were victims of brainwashing. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the opinion column in Scientific American, headlined "The Caveman and the Bomb," conveys, just a little more colorfully, the sense one got from the Senate hearing on the process involved in the use of a nuclear weapon. Put simply, folks are scared that Donald Trump may not understand the difference between threats to rain fire and fury on the people of North Korea and the devastating reality of nuclear war. But while we're talking about the dangers of Trump having his hand on the figurative button, we should also be asking why we maintain a world-ending arsenal at all. We'll hear from William Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, about what drives nuclear weapons production. Also on the show, countries from around the world are grappling with the current and coming impacts of climate disruption at the UN conference in Bonn, Germany. The Trump administration, for its part, contributed what was described as a surreal event promoting fossil fuels. We'll talk about the disconnect between the White House and the rest of the planet on climate change with Karen Orenstein, Deputy Director of Economic Policy at Friends of the Earth. That's all coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. You could say the New York Times is very interested in the squashing of free speech on college campuses. But as research by FAIR analyst Adam Johnson shows, that wouldn't quite describe it. Over the past 18 months, the New York Times has dedicated 21 columns and articles to the subject of conservatives' free speech on campus, while just three talked about the silencing of college liberals or leftists. Johnson reviewed Times articles, columns, and op-eds and found a clear emphasis on documenting and condemning the perceived suppression of right-wing voices at American universities, but vanishingly little mention of harassment campaigns against leftist professors and/or the criminalization of leftist causes, such as the pro-Palestinian BDS, or Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. Since May 1, 2016, the Times has run pieces like "College Republicans, Once the Best Party on Campus, Endure Taunts Over Trump," "My Liberal University Cemented My Vote for Trump," "On Campus, Trump Fans Say They Need Safe Spaces," "The Isolation of College Libertarians," "Life and Combat for Republicans at Berkeley," and "These Campus Inquisitions Must Stop." While the paper did sporadically report the dozens of laws throughout the country that seek to criminalize BDS, they didn't put that in the context of college free speech. Professors silenced or fired over activities critical of Israel, like Berkeley's Paul Hadway or SUNY Plattsburgh's Simona Sharoni, weren't covered, much less defended, in the Times, leaving much more room for pearl-clutching over the lack of far-right professors or the mean things said about Trump supporters by undergrads. Besides the odd notion that college campuses should be one-to-one hospitable to all ideologies at all times, the idea that certain viewpoints, like supply-side economics, racial eugenics, or a Eurocentric view of history, are underrepresented on campus because they aren't intellectually credible is never entertained. So Johnson concludes on the dubious altar of ideological diversity, the paper of record sacrifices any sense of proportionality. With alt-right and neo-Nazi elements on the march and a White House that's, at the very least, sympathetic to them, the Times focuses its tremendous influence time and again on creating a space in academia for reactionary, racist, and sexist views that are overrepresented in almost every other sector of society. And finally, one of the most important and also kindest media critics has passed away. Edward Herman was the main author of Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, written with Noam Chomsky, a 1980s masterwork that exposed how elite U.S. media typically function as propaganda organs for U.S. empire and militarism. FAIR founder Jeff Cohen recalled how, as part of a lawyer's delegation monitoring an election in death squad-run El Salvador in 1984, He and a group of progressive attorneys at the Salvador Sheraton scrambled to get their hands on a shipment of hot-off-the-press copies of Demonstration Elections, Ed's devastating book with Frank Broadhead about the U.S. staging elections as PR shows to prop up repressive regimes, from the Dominican Republic to Vietnam to Salvador. Ed wrote or co-wrote classic works of political and media criticism, including The Political Economy of Human Rights, The Real Terror Network, Beyond Hypocrisy, Decoding the News in an Age of Propaganda, and The Global Media. A longtime friend and supporter of FAIR, he occasionally wrote for our magazine Extra on, for example, double standards in coverage of Suharto and Pol Pot. Jeff Cohen notes that Ed's name often went unmentioned in discussion of manufacturing consent, for example, in the Hollywood movie Good Will Hunting. Asked if that troubled him, Ed answered, not at all. The point is, the movie could bring the book more readers. That was Ed. He will be missed. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. We have this idea that things should make sense, but we have homeless people and empty buildings. We have unemployed people and work that needs doing. And we have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet and are building more. The thing is, these things do make sense, just not in a way we would hope for or the way we are often told. When it comes to nuclear weapons, our next guest explains, all the talk you hear about strategic considerations driving proliferation, how do we look tough with North Korea and so on, is in a sense a distraction from what's really going on. If you really want to know why the U.S. keeps churning out nuclear warheads, follow the money. William Hartung has been doing just that for years now. He's director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, author most recently of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and a contributor to the book Sleepwalking to Armageddon, The Threat of Nuclear Annihilation, which is just out now from New Press. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome back to Counterspin, William Hartung.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a hearing on the authority and process for the use of nuclear weapons. One senator said constituents are asking him at town halls if Trump can just order a nuclear attack without any controls. And obviously that's because they're worried that he might. As you write, a tough guy attitude on nuclear weapons, when combined with an apparent ignorance about their world-ending potential, adds up to a toxic brew. No argument there. Let's start by just talking about the current state of the arsenal that we're being told needs to be modernized and expanded. We have what, some 4,000 nuclear weapons?
Yes, in the active stockpile. So any of those could be deployed at any time. There's a little under 2,000 ready to go now on ballistic missiles and in submarines, on bombers, and that's far more than would be needed to destroy North Korea. That would be a handful of weapons, pretty much disable and destroy any country in the world. And if there were a large exchange, probably end the prospects of life on the planet over the medium term. So there's massive nuclear overkill. And, you know, some experts, those who believe in nuclear deterrence as opposed to getting rid of nuclear weapons, say about 300 would be enough to dissuade any country from attacking the United States with nuclear weapons. So you've got huge excess. Some of it is, you know, leftover ideology from the Cold War, but as I said, most of it is power and profits.
Well, let's get into that, because despite the arsenal you've just described, we are looking at a modernization plan to the tune of some $1.7 trillion. I'll ask it simply, why is that the case?
Well, I think the nuclear enterprise is on autopilot. They always build a new generation. The companies always need a new contract. The Pentagon cooked this up under Obama, so it's not, unlike many other things, a Trump invention. But General Dynamics wants to make new nuclear submarines. Companies like Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin want to make new nuclear bombers. The Ballistic Missile Force, which is based in Wyoming, North Dakota, some in Nebraska, et cetera, the senators from those states are very keen on a new generation of ballistic missiles because they're afraid they might get dropped from the arsenal if they're not brand new and shiny. So there's a lot of pork barrel politics involved, and also just kind of bureaucracies want to be fed, and they want to be fed dollars, both in the Pentagon and the services and, of course, the companies.
I think it was from you that I learned about the strategy, if you will, of breaking up the production process of a particular weapon so that you'll have many states and their representatives invested in it.
Exactly. And the nuclear complex is very much that way. You've got weapons labs in California, New Mexico. You've got a uranium facility in Tennessee. You've got submarines based in Washington State and Georgia. You've got those ballistic missiles in the northern Midwest, as I mentioned. Connecticut's building nuclear-capable submarines, and on and on. So if you put together the senators and representatives from those states, it's kind of a solid block. I'll support your nuke if you support mine. You've already got a huge group in Congress pushing for this stuff. And, you know, when Chuck Hagel, for example, was being confirmed as Secretary of Defense, he had signed on as an advisor to a project by the group Global Zero that said we could get by with as few as 900 nuclear weapons, not the 4,000, and also perhaps we didn't need ballistic missiles. And he was pilloried by members from states that have the missiles or the command and control for the missiles and so forth, to the point where he basically backed off and said, well, that was just one idea. You know, that was a study. That doesn't mean it's something we're going to do. So Congress is a big part of the problem.
Well, I'd like to do a little bit of history, as you do in this piece for Tom Dispatch, because it seems as though we used to see this in a more clear-eyed way. I mean, Eisenhower pretty much called it, right, with the military-industrial complex.
Yes, and he was most concerned about things like the push for a new nuclear bomber by the contractors in the Air Force. Some generals who, you know, he was the commander-in-chief after all, were talking out of school about needing this even though he thought we didn't. He basically called the push for the bomber and the false claims about a missile gap that were used to fuel a missile buildup political demagoguery. And he said that basically there was undue influence on senators like John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, by the industry to get them to adopt these positions. So he was right on target way back then, and I think he would be horrified to see the shape of the nuclear industrial complex now, the size of the companies like Lockheed Martin, which gets $30 to $40 billion a year, you know, in a good year for them, not a good year for the taxpayers. So there were no companies of that size in Eisenhower's day, and they have that much more influence because of their spread across the country, their campaign contributions, their lobbyists, and so forth.
Well, I was just going to go there because the mechanics, the techniques, you say, haven't really changed fundamentally, and that is campaign contributions and lobbying. And it's not partisan. It's bipartisan.
Exactly. So, for example, the entire weapons industry has, in any given year, 700 to 1,000 registered lobbyists, almost two for every member of Congress in some years. And that's not counting, you know, board members and people who consult and other people who try to influence the process but aren't, you know, technically lobbyists. They give tens of millions of dollars in contributions. They also fund think tanks like the Center for Security Policy, the Lexington Institute, the Democratic-leaning Center for New American Security. In many cases, those think tanks advocate positions that the logical conclusion is we need more Pentagon spending. So they're almost like, in some cases, mouthpieces for the industry, but very useful because the industry doesn't have to lobby for it themselves. It's being done under the kind of alleged aura of objectivity, which, of course, doesn't exist when you're on the payroll of the arms industry.
Well, and media, of course, play a role here in a general failure to indicate, you know, which think tanks are tied to where, so that they do kind of abet this process of presenting them as independent entities that just happen to have a point of view that dovetails with that of weapons makers.
Yeah, we need truth in labeling, basically.
Yes, exactly. Well, and another thing that media can play a role in is credulous, shall we say, reporting of another angle of approach, which is that weapons are about jobs.
Yes, well, the thing is, Pentagon spending is the least effective way to create jobs. Economists at the University of Massachusetts have done very good work on this, and they've figured out infrastructure spending is about 1.5 times as many jobs as Pentagon spending and education spending more than twice as many. So it's really about serving particular areas and members. You know, if you have a fighter plane built in St. Louis, the Missouri delegation is going to push for that. If you have nuclear capable submarine in Connecticut, the delegation is going to push for it. And those, as you said, are both Democrats and Republicans. So it's not that we couldn't create jobs differently. It's that there's a political logjam in Washington against investing in other things.
Well, let me just ask you finally, you remind us that grassroots activism in Europe and in the U.S., the Freeze movement, that was what played a role in helping turn around Ronald Reagan's view on nuclear weapons. Is that what we need now?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, globally, there's been some hope. I mean, the U.N. has passed a treaty to abolish nuclear weapons, which many people thought would not be possible. And the majority of the world's countries are behind that. Of course, the big players are not. But I think this puts them on the moral defensive and the political defensive such that if we can build the movement here, we might make some progress. And of course, all bets are off about what Donald Trump himself might do. But I think there's already building support in Congress for a new policy, including not letting the president be the sole person to decide if we launch a nuclear war.
We've been speaking with William Hartung. His article, Massive Overkill, brought to you by the Nuclear Industrial Complex, can be found on tomdispatch.com. And the new book, Sleepwalking to Armageddon, The Threat of Nuclear Annihilation, is out from New Press. William Hartung, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
A New York Times explainer in advance of the Bonn climate talks told readers the worst-case scenario for the UN summit is it, quote, could get bogged down by the traditional rifts between richer and poorer nations, close quote. That might, quote, stall momentum right before the next big round of climate talks in 2018, close quote. Of course, others may see different forces behind any stalled momentum and might offer a different frame for questions of climate justice than that of a traditional rift between the world's rich and poor. Karen Orenstein is the deputy director of the Economic Policy Program at Friends of the Earth U.S., where she works on issues of international public finance and climate finance in particular. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Karen Orenstein.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, I have to start with the event that inspired a statement from you and that boggled so many. Here we're at an international conference to address the reality of human-driven climate disruption. It's in Germany, but it's hosted by Fiji in part to highlight the problems facing island nations, problems caused by other countries' emissions. And the Trump administration does a presentation titled The Role of Cleaner and More Efficient Fossil Fuels and Nuclear Power in Climate Mitigation. What the heck?
I think you introduced it correctly by talking about this was in response to, you know, the reality of climate change, but Trump and his administration live in a parallel universe that is not based in reality. So it is not a surprise that, you know, they're climate deniers. For them, upside is down and downside is up, so that they would go to a climate conference, the most important climate talks of the year, to try to promote climate pollution. It's just what they do.
It's truly strange, you know, but Barry Worthington, the executive director of the United States Energy Association, who spoke at this panel, he told the New York Times beforehand, he's just going to be delivering a dose of reality. You know, he says no credible projection shows fossil fuels meeting less than 40% of global energy. He just says it's going to be a horrible experience for him to have to deliver that message to climate activists. But, quote, the reality of it is the world is going to continue to use fossil fuels. And if I can throw myself on the hand grenade to help people realize that, I'm willing to do it, close quote. So their argument is they're just being realistic.
Isn't he nice to make such sacrifices? I think, again, it comes down to the question of reality. His reality as a fossil fuel executive is one thing. The reality of, say, for example, someone living in Bangladesh whose home is now, you know, getting inundated with water, or in Kiribati or Tuvalu or Marshall Islands or Fiji, which is hosting the conference, for them, their reality is that their country faces an existential crisis because it might not exist anymore, or farmers in Malawi whose crops aren't working, or people in Houston or Florida or Puerto Rico who just encountered storms that have like unprecedented vigor to them and resulted in unprecedented destruction. That's their reality. So I would believe more the farmer in Bangladesh than I would believe the coal and oil executive like Barry Worthington.
Well, I want to bring you back to this question of climate finance. What does that mean? What questions are being addressed by that?
Well, basically, that's about the provision of money from rich countries to poor countries to help the poorer countries, you know, adapt to the unavoidable impacts of climate change and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Because to do that is, A, very expensive, and B, they're not the ones responsible for causing the climate crisis, right? The U.S., more than any other country in the history of the world, is most responsible for causing the climate crisis. So we abide by the idea of the polluter pays principle, the idea that if you walk into a shop and you break something, you're in charge of paying for it. Well, we sort of broke the climate. We're responsible for paying for it, the U.S. and other rich countries. And so that's really what climate finance is about. It's both about justice, it's about practicality, it's about expense, and it's about morality.
So what it sounds like it's not about is an age-old traditional rift, you know, that will always be with us between the world's rich and the world's poor. You make it much more dynamic than that.
Yeah, I really dislike that framing. So the rift is caused because wealthy countries have damaged the climate in incredible ways, and it's having the first and worst impact on countries, for example, in Africa. And so it's about people in Africa saying, we need to be able to live. We deserve a life of dignity. The actions of people in richer countries have impinged on their ability to have sort of a dignified life. I don't know. I wouldn't call that a rift. I would call that about fairness and justice and basically the right to livelihoods and to a quality life. It's not a rift. A rift makes it sound like there's, like, you know, people disagreeing over whether, you know, bananas are the best fruit, you know, and it's not. This is people's lives.
Well, this event that we're talking about, this fossil fuel described as surreal event at the climate talks, it was interrupted. I want to be clear, you know, before it even started, two U.S. governors from Washington and Oregon came in and said, you know, this is not, we don't agree with this. This is not our view. And then young activists who were there interrupted with a 7-minute song, you know, and then left peacefully. At the same time, we saw the largest ever climate protest in Germany. I feel that people understand that what we're talking about is a matter of political will and not some sort of arcane science question or technology question. It seems that activism really is going to be the core to moving forward here.
Yeah, I agree. There's not rocket science here. It is entirely political. The fact that, you know, 95% plus of, you know, scientists agree that humans are causing climate change is causing global warming, et cetera, it's a fact. It's about entrenched interests in wealthier countries, you know, the fossil fuel industry, for example, Wall Street. They want to maintain the status quo to their benefit. And I think we often see governments not necessarily acting in the best interest of their constituencies. That's certainly true of the Trump administration. So to necessarily expect that governments with their own vested economic interests are going to, you know, necessarily do what is needed for the benefit of, you know, the average ordinary people and the planet is probably not entirely in line with sort of the history of civilization, which is to say that I think we're going to find the answers in the streets. The demand will come from the streets and from just everyday folks who take action, especially now people are so inspired to act because, I mean, Trump is just such an extreme villain in so many ways, including on the climate.
Well, I have to note in this context a new study from Public Citizen that showed that media severely underreport activism at climate conferences, even though those demonstrations are really a primary way that the public is claiming a voice here, and that underreporting distorts public understanding. It gives the impression that there's less support for this action than there actually is. I wonder what, in general, you might like to see from media more of or less of more broadly on not just climate talks, but on this whole set of issues. What do you think journalism can do here?
Yeah, I agree. There's a big problem with corporate control of media, and also this idea of that they're afraid to wade into the controversy of climate change, which isn't actually a controversy. So I would, for example, like to see during weather reports, meteorologists talk about climate change because that affects the weather in an extreme way. So that actually, you know, your daily, nightly newscast, which a lot of people watch when they, you know, when they have the Doppler radar and all that stuff, they can talk about climate change. Yeah, certainly to be honest with you, most of my own news comes from Democracy Now! And alternative sources. And until I think we have less media consolidation and more local, decentralized media, it's going to be up to people on the ground to get their stories out and to pay attention to alternative sources of information. But I mean, I think things are changing. I'm from Illinois. I go back home, talk to my family, and they think about climate change in a way that they didn't before. And they're not a bunch of very political people. Mm-hmm. So I think things are changing, especially with the devastation that's happened in the United States, and especially with just how extreme Trump is.
So maybe not thanks to media or thanks to government, but things are nevertheless changing in terms of awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe in spite of media and the government.
All right, then. I'll have to end it there. We've been speaking with Karen Orenstein of Friends of the Earth U.S. You can find their work online at foe.org. Karen Orenstein, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find the interviews and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It is hard to know if the ultimate threats to our existence are real. A small group of people, including a couple of scientists, say humans will go extinct this century. The cause, they say, is a complex of climate disaster, social meltdown, and then multiple nuclear meltdowns. Most of the scientists on Radio EcoShock agree climate-driven disasters will emerge in multiple forms, but they expect humans will continue. In this program, we will interview a scientist who just shed more light on why mass extinctions happen, and the thresholds that precede them. It's cutting-edge science, but spoiler alert, if you are expecting to witness the end in your lifetime, you may be disappointed. Then we are off to the dense forests of Indonesia and the vast palm plantations that are replacing them. It's a tale of corruption, and many of the products you buy contain at least some palm oil. Others burn it to generate electricity, claiming it is green energy. And now, with an in-depth investigation by Monga Bay, we find out what it really costs. If you don't care about that, care about this. With little industry or transportation, Indonesia still edges into the number three spot as a huge source of greenhouse gases, at times behind only China and the United States. That matters. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Are we headed for a sixth mass extinction? Experts are asking, and a new paper from MIT brings us some more answers. The possible cause of ecological collapse may surprise you. Here to explain is the author Daniel H. Rothman. He is a professor of geophysics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Rothman is also co-director with Carrie Emanuel of the Lorenz Center at MIT. From Cambridge, Massachusetts, Daniel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, actually. Now, some biologists say that we are entering a mass extinction, and I've spoken with climate scientists right here on Radio EcoShock that worry about that, too. You and a half dozen other scientists tackled that question in 2015, but for reasons that I hadn't heard before, please explain how a change in microbial life could do us in.
Okay. You're referring to an earlier paper of mine.
Yes.
And this is a paper that appeared in PNAS, and it suggested that the end-Permian extinction, which occurred about 251 million years ago, may have been aided by the evolution of a specific microbe that had the ability to efficiently metabolize a certain form of organic matter and turn it into methane.
All right, but we've been hearing mostly on the past extinctions about macro events like asteroid hits and volcanic eruptions. Are you saying that those are less important, or is this something that you're adding to that discussion?
It's probably the case that the general public thinks that an impact by an extraterrestrial object is the typical cause of mass extinctions. And that's because there is one instance, the extinction at the end of the Cretaceous that gave rise to the extinction of that killed the dinosaurs, has been shown to be the result of an impact with a bolide. However, none of the other major extinctions have been associated with that kind of evidence. So I think it's fair to say now, 30 to 40 years after the discovery of the possible cause of the KT extinction, that other effects are irrelevant. Indeed, the other effects that are probably most commonly discussed today are also relevant to the one at the end of the Cretaceous, and that's the influence of massive volcanism. We now know, due to some very sophisticated studies in high-resolution geochronology in the last several years, that major episodes of volcanism are associated with at least three of the so-called Big Five mass extinctions. That's the one at the end of the Cretaceous, the one at the end of the Triassic, and the one at the end of the Permian. So the work of mine that you're referring to set out in part to understand how it is that such a major volcanic event might give rise to mass extinction.
Now, to grasp your newly published science, I think we are going to need a lesson on the role of respiration in the carbon cycle. It's something that I find difficult to grasp. Could you give us the basics in that?
Sure. My recent paper in Science Advances that you're referring to is indeed based on how the carbon cycle works. And one can think of the carbon cycle as being a kind of loop. Plants take CO2 out of the atmosphere or the oceans, and they make organic matter. And animals consume that organic matter and use oxygen in the process, usually using oxygen. And bacteria can use other oxidants. And in the process of the metabolism of the organic matter, they return the CO2 to the environment. This back reaction, the return of CO2 to the environment, is known in physiology as respiration. So the carbon cycle is a loop between photosynthesis on the one hand, which takes the CO2 out of the system, and respiration, which returns it back.
Right. So we're talking about your new paper, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System. It was published in the journal Science Advances in September 2017. And, you know, animal life as we know it began with the Cambrian explosion about half a billion years ago, but less than 100 million years later, 86% of all those species were wiped out in a mass extinction event. Does your paper address some of those causes? I mean, why did it happen?
My paper doesn't address the cause of the end Ordovician extinction, which I believe you're referring to. And so there are commonly thought to be the five biggest extinctions are commonly thought to be the ones at the end of the Ordovician, at the end of the Devonian, that's about 400 million years ago, and then the other three that I mentioned earlier. In fact, my paper doesn't really provide the causes of any of these. Instead, what it does is that it points out that, let me backtrack a moment, it sets out to answer a simple question. And the simple question is posed by two basic observations. The first observation is that every time we've seen a major mass extinction, the big five that I just referred to, we know without any doubt that there has been associated with it a major disruption of Earth's carbon cycle. That, in a sense, is one of the great achievements of the Earth sciences in the last several decades. Another great achievement of the Earth sciences in the last several decades is the observation that there are a great many perturbations of the carbon cycle throughout geologic time. These often give rise to periods of climate change, as has been detailed in many instances. Now, there's on the order of a few dozen major perturbations of the carbon cycle. When there's a mass extinction, there's always one. However, there's a great many others for which there is no mass extinction. So a natural question to ask is what sets the two groups apart, basically the benign events from the malign events. And so that's what I tried to show. And I did that by analyzing in some detail the ways in which the carbon cycle behaved for all of these events, and 31 in total.
And part of that cycle is carbon stored in the deep ocean, and it's not something we normally think about. I mean, we're interested in what's in the atmosphere. And so how does the deep ocean carbon get into this picture?
In an interesting way. You're right that we don't normally think of carbon in the deep ocean. So the deep ocean actually, compared to the atmosphere, contains vastly more carbon, about 50 times more carbon than the atmosphere contains. And then sediments contain much, much more than that. So a particular form of that carbon interested me in performing both of the studies that you're referring to. And that's the carbon that's basically locked up in the ocean and in organic matter and in sediments as organic matter. That is a consequence of the forward reaction of the carbon cycle, the conversion of CO2 into plant matter. It turns out that some of that plant matter just endures nearly forever. It's that is the carbon cycle of this loop that I described before is not entirely, it's not an entirely closed loop. There's a little bit that leaks out, a very tiny amount, but that tiny amount is environmentally very significant. It ends up sitting around in the ocean for upwards of about 5,000 years, and there's another bit that ends up in sediments for, you know, millions and millions of years. It just, you know, waits for a large tectonic cycle to result in its uplift back into rocks, in which it's then remobilized back into the system. So the upshot is that there's this slow pool of carbon which is effectively reactive, but it reacts at some, you know, a very slow rate for reasons that we don't really understand. And so both papers basically contain within them the assumption that it's possible to remobilize this pool.
And that would be dangerous for us all if it happened. Do you think that human emissions of carbon or our stimulations of carbon through agriculture and all the things that we do could have any role in stimulating a release of that long-held carbon?
That's an interesting question. It's not so easy to make such an extrapolation of these ideas. Remember that we're talking about organic matter that's locked up in the deep ocean. The oceans are voluminous, and to actually make contact with all that organic matter would not only take a new process, but it would take a lot of time, and that's certainly also true for the sediments. So human influence, I don't think you can expect it to have any direct impact on these pools. However, it could have an indirect impact. That is, it could stimulate some other process which could then be responsible for changing the size of these pools.
Well, it's interesting. In your paper, you say, quote, an unstable trajectory would reach its maximum extent roughly 10 to the fourth years after the threshold is breached. And that sounds like the extinction process could be triggered, but we'd still have tens of thousands of years left for human civilization. So what's the worry?
I didn't say we should be worried about that. I don't think I mentioned worry at all in the paper. So the issue in the paper basically addresses how the carbon cycle works. And so there's this question that one can ask, which I think is a very natural question to ask, is the carbon cycle stable? You know, so let's take the idea you mentioned in your previous question. Suppose we stimulate the system somehow unknowingly. We make some change. Are we sure that the carbon cycle is going to go on its own merry path independent of that? My suggestion in the paper is that no, we can't be sure. And basically, the analysis doesn't really focus on mechanisms of such stimulation, but it basically asks under what conditions lead to a carbon cycle that is unstable. And I developed those ideas in the paper, and they are the ones that then lead to the expression of critical thresholds. And those critical thresholds basically act as, what in physical science we would call a stability boundary. So on one side of this boundary, the system is stable. That's the one that we think we have now. And on the other side, it appears unstable.
Okay. So the key question then is, what are these critical boundaries, and would we know if we'd crossed one?
So let's first talk about what the critical boundaries are. So this is the main crux of the paper. Right. One of them has long been hypothesized, and that's the following. It's long been thought, going back to the earliest days in which people, theorized about mass extinction, and I would date that back to the 18th century. Right. The idea is that the environment changes too fast for ecosystems to keep up with. Right. So that implicitly suggests that there is a critical rate of change. Beyond that critical rate is not a good thing, right? So if you study the geologic past, what you find out is that, this is, possibly true, but then what is that critical rate? And so one of the contributions of my paper is to identify that critical rate, and it comes through a combination of theoretical reasoning and building of a database and analyzing the data. But that's only part of the puzzle, because now if we try to ask ourselves, as you said earlier, should we worry about this? And when I say we and worry, I'm basically saying, there's a human time scale. Let's define a human time scale to be on the order of centuries. And on the order of centuries, does the rate really matter? So let's imagine that we even make that an even tighter period. Let's say during this discussion, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go up by a few parts per million. We will hang up our phones. Your listeners will go back and outside after being inside, and they will not notice at all. The carbon dioxide levels have gone up a few ppm, and no organism will notice the difference. However, the rate of change, that is the amount by which it increased divided by the time over which it changed, would be astronomical compared to any event in the geologic past. So does that mean that we should really care about the rate? And it means, no, that we shouldn't if we're concerned with a very short event. And so the idea in the paper, which is proposed, is that for short events, what matters is the amount of the change rather than the rate of the change. So I was referring earlier to an effectively infinite rate, but it's not dangerous because it's of only a small amount. And then the paper goes a little bit further because, there's this question of a critical rate at long time scales, and then a critical size or amount at short time scales. And the question really is, how does one identify them? So what the paper does is it derives a relation between those two. It shows how to predict the critical size of a fast perturbation from the critical rate of a slow perturbation given one other quantity, and that quantity is the time scale at which changes are damped out by the carbon cycle. And that leads to a very simple relation, and the paper finds the critical rate through a combination of observation and theory. The time scale comes from an understanding of how the carbon cycle works, and then that leads to a prediction for the critical amount. That amount is basically corresponds to on the order of 300 gigatons of carbon added to the oceans. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've added about 150. Any compilation or any prediction of how much will be added over the course of the present century suggests that at least another 150 will be added, and that would bring us beyond the predicted threshold.
So you are saying that in the direction we're going now, we are going to cross the threshold where a mass extinction event would be more likely.
Correct. And a more precise reading would say the following. Sometime during the present century, we will pass the threshold. We will effectively have crossed our best understanding of where a stability boundary in the carbon cycle might lie. And the question is, what happens next? Well, it turns out that the damping timescale of the carbon cycle is about 10,000 years, and so too would be the development of any instability within the carbon cycle. So that means that any deleterious effects that would be developing as a consequence of passing that threshold would play out over a long time. Now, what they would lead to and how fast they become, you know, serious is an entirely open question. So, I mean, we have no real conception of how this system works. This is essentially, at this point, an abstract idea of there being a stability threshold and the understanding that the other side would put us in a kind of unknown territory. But how that works is a subject of, you know, something that requires, you know, more research.
How are scientists going to use the work that you've just published?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's been out there on the internet now for 6 weeks, and, you know, things don't develop that fast, so I can't say, right? Let me see if I can answer you nevertheless. On the part of this scientist, I am motivated to use the empirical observations of this paper to devise a theory for what happens when you cross the stability boundary. I'm sure other people will be interested in doing the same, but there's another benefit or application or understanding of this paper that I think is important to impart. In earth science, there's a very active part of earth science which studies the past. People interested in climate science think of this as, you know, paleoclimate. But as a subject of basic science, it's basically one of earth history. You know, how did the earth develop into what it is today? How did life develop into what it is today? And how did the two co-develop? It's sometimes referred to as a co-evolution problem. In this coevolution problem, there is always the question of, okay, you have this event like the end Permian extinction, which plays out over, you know, perhaps 60,000 years. I mean, it's between 10,000 and 100,000 years, right? How do we use that kind of knowledge to inform what is happening today over a period of centuries? So my paper provides a solution to that problem. And to me, that's been a very significant problem for some time, because geologically speaking, in geologic time, there's lots of changes, the 31 changes I referred to earlier. But how they inform what's going on today has never been clear, because they're slow compared to the rapid changes of today. So I think, you know, if nothing else, my paper suggests that there's a new way of looking at the old events, you know, the events in the past, and extracting, you know, information of contemporary significance.
As an aside, I know you've done some research into the properties of carbon in storage. Do you think carbon capture and storage is a workable technology?
You know, it's going on now, and I, you know, some people think it's successful. My own opinion is that it's a technology which should be considered seriously because, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, how do we avoid the crisis that I'm pointing out as possible? Well, there is a very simple suggestion, and that's to put less CO2 into the atmosphere. And among the many ways of putting less CO2 into the atmosphere is to bury some of it into the ground. And so, I mean, it's certainly something that should be considered.
And could you please tell us about the Lorenz Center and your own Rothman Group at MIT?
I'd be delighted to. Thanks for asking. So the Lorenz Center is a kind of climate think tank that I co-founded along with my colleague, Kerry Emanuel. And our objective in founding the Lorenz Center has been to feature climate science as a curiosity-driven enterprise. We all understand that an understanding of climate is of huge practical importance, and you know the ways in which the climate may change, you know, has a profound impact on our lives and in successive generations. But in this discussion, it's somehow been lost that we don't really understand the system that well, and that we need to make predictions as well as we can, but there's more to this science than merely making predictions. There's also developing a better understanding. And the development of a better understanding comes from inspiring, you know, the best young people, the best minds in science, to come join the effort. And so what we've done at MIT is to create this center, the Lorenz Center, to attract people to this effort. And to do that, we're trying to seek private funding and to build an endowment. And it's also of interest to point out why we call it the Lorenz Center. The name Lorenz is the name of our late colleague Ed Lorenz, who is not only a meteorologist and a climate scientist, but perhaps best known for his development of the theory of chaos. And this is an interesting example in which a scientist interested in understanding the natural world around him, specifically the weather and whether it was predictable, made fundamental impacts that pervade all of science because he was trying to ask under what conditions might one be able to predict the evolution of a system and under what conditions might one not be able to predict it. The not being able to predict category falls under the rubric of chaos, and it's had tremendous influence on science in general in the last half century. And we would hope to carry on that tradition by attracting bright young people to the world of climate science, in which they'll make contributions not only to climate science itself, but also to science in general. Within my own group, what we do is we basically apply mathematics to problems like these and to others, and we're particularly interested in the kinds of dynamical systems that Lorenz studied to such great profit.
We have been talking with Daniel H. Rothman, professor of geophysics and co-director of the Lorenz Center at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His paper, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System, is open access, so you can read it for yourself. You can find links to that and much else that we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks very much for inviting me on the program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Isn't Daniel Rothman a great scientific mind? There is so much to what he just said. I recommend you download or listen to that interview again. That's easily done from my blog for this week's show at ecoshock.org. You can play it right on the page, or you can download it and listen to it later. I am not a scientist, as you know, but I would like to discuss this interview with Dr. Rothman. These are my own opinions, and any errors are mine alone. Before we get to the nagging questions about what drives extinction, let me emphasize what may have slipped by in this interview. If I understand things correctly, in an earlier work, Daniel Rothman studied changes in microbial life at the sea bottom that can increase releases of carbon or methane. We all want to talk about asteroids or volcanoes or human emissions, things we can see. But large-scale changes may come about by forces unseen. Microbes may find our carbon loading as a new opportunity, whether at the sea bottom or newly thawed land in Canada, Alaska, and Siberia, the microbial world may intervene heavily
in our history.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
But our guest Daniel Rothman is now publishing about very different things. As you heard in this interview, his new paper addresses a long-held theory about how climate change can lead to mass extinction. It has happened at least 5 times in Earth's history. The explanation often given, including by some guests here on Radio EcoShock, is that plants and animals are not able to keep up with the pace of climate change. Conditions change too fast, and species go extinct. Rothman tells us that is not the case, or at least not the primary driver of mass extinction. His in-depth studies of the carbon cycle going back hundreds of millions of years gives a different result. It is the amount of change that drives extinction, rather than the speed of change. That is a fundamental point, and it might reorient future science and perhaps public policy. But I am cautious about this result, precisely because Dr. Rothman is talking about one of the slow, grand cycles on this planet. Carbon is taken up by plants and then released as they die, and that's called respiration. The rate of respiration is not equivalent to carbon consumption, partly because some animals and plants sink to the bottom of the sea. Their carbon may rest there for centuries or much longer. It's like a leak in the carbon system. As a result, there's a huge amount of carbon held in the deep sea bottom, much more than found in the atmosphere. My understanding from this interview is that when thresholds are reached, microbes at the sea bottom can change towards releasing more carbon or even methane, which is many times more potent as a warming gas. But this change in the carbon cycle, Rothman says, is not instant or even likely in coming generations. Studies of past extinction events reveal that when a threshold is reached, the process change may not trigger a global event until perhaps 10,000 years later. This is not the stuff of the near-term extinction crowd. But then Rothman says, we don't really know how the carbon system works. Despite a century of scientific study and concentrated work in the last couple of decades, we still don't know, and that is very dangerous. At least with this study, Rothman is able to tell us what the threshold is. The level of carbon that could trigger the big slow release can be measured in gigatons of carbon added to the ocean. He says 300 gigatons of carbon added to the seas would do it. We've added 150 gigatons since the Industrial Revolution began, and most scientists expect we will put the other 150 gigatons in the seas by the end of this century. My take on this interview is that by the year 2100, we will indeed reach the trigger point for a release of those deep ocean stores of carbon. But the impact may not be evident for a very long time. If the carbon cycle change takes 10,000 years, it is like saying when humans first started farming, we began climate warming. That was 10,000 years ago or so. Of course, there are scientists who say that is true. Agriculture began a slow climate change. But in this case, the result 10,000 years later would be mass extinction, a situation humans would be unlikely to survive. It's like a long-term curse on the distant future. Meanwhile, right now, we are running a whole new experiment with atmospheric chemistry. The rate of our addition of carbon is unheard of. Even conservative reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say we won't have to wait long for climate disasters to become the new normal. My uneducated guess is that we are facing multiple processes. There is a very long-term cycle involving deep-sea carbon reserves, but everything else I get from climate science suggests there are also fast-moving operations which can destabilize weather, remap the coastline by the end of this century, and sooner than that. We need to know a lot more about fast and slow climate drivers and the relationships, if any, between them. We'll just have to keep going with research, and Radio EcoShock until we get it. But already, there is enough evidence in the melting poles, record set, and continuing disasters to demand rapid decarbonization. In the words of a recent idiot, do something.
Radio EcoShock.
The rainforests of Indonesia are up for grabs. Never mind the indigenous people or the wild animals. Step right up and clear it all away for palm oil. You just need a shell company or two and bags full of money for local governors. That's the sad story coming out of the island that used to be called Borneo. It's all laid bare in some great investigative reporting from Monga Bay and the Gecko Project. We have the Indonesia editor for Monga Bay on the line, Philip Jacobson. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, it's great to be here, Alex.
All right. You know, Phil, we only have 30 seconds to explain why this matters to listeners in other countries, including North America and Europe. Please tell us how Indonesia at one point became the world's third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions.
Sure. Indonesia has one of the highest rates of deforestation in the world, and this is a major contributor to global climate change. Indonesia also has the most peatlands in the world. And this is a sort of carbon-rich landscape, and these are also rapidly being converted into oil palm plantations and also timber plantations. So all of this is fueling climate change.
When I started monitoring Indonesian news for a big organization in the late 1980s, it was all about logging and deforestation. When did palm oil plantations hit the scene?
Palm oil really exploded in Indonesia in the 2000s. There were some experiments with large-scale oil palm plantations in the previous decades, but it really took off after the fall of the dictator Suharto in 1998. So after he fell from power, there was this massive decentralization of power from the central government to the regions. And as part of this decentralization, Indonesia's district chiefs, the head of its districts all across the country, were given all kinds of new powers, especially over natural resources. This included the power to hand out permits for oil palm plantations and also to mine coal. So what we saw happen in Indonesia was widespread abuse of these powers by district chiefs, who are known as bupatis in Indonesia. And this is at the root of why Indonesia has lost so much of its forest cover in recent years. And it's what we look at in our article, The Palm Oil Fiefdom, and also in other articles in the series.
Yeah, your description of how the Bupatis took economic power into their own families reminds me of the formation of the Russian oligarchs after the Soviet Union fell in the early 1990s. But originally, this was an attempt to put more democracy out of Jakarta and into the other parts of Indonesia, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. It was supposed to make government more accountable to people. So Indonesia had just come off of the 32-year New Order dictatorship, which was presided over by Suharto, who is often, you know, he's called the most corrupt leader in modern history in the world. His family stole billions of dollars from Indonesia. And as you said earlier, a lot of that was based on logging the rainforest. So, you know, Suharto would hand out a logging concession to a company owned by a crony of his. And there were all kinds of corrupt schemes that his family participated in. But, you know, this decentralization was intended to It was sold as a way of countering that and actually making these local governments more accountable to people. But what actually happened was the corruption was simply moved down through the system to the local level. And today, Indonesia's district chiefs or bupatis are seen as some of the most corrupt officials in the country. I think it was the interior minister of the previous administration came out with a figure that like some more than half of all bupatis in the country were linked to corruption scandals. And it often has to do with natural resources. Indonesia has incredible natural resources, whether it's timber, minerals, or just land, which can be used for oil palm plantations.
Well, let's talk about this palm oil. What is it used for and how do they make it?
Palm oil is used in many, many products that we find at the grocery store, that we find in, you know, convenience stores. It's in snack foods, it's in frozen pizza, it's in ice cream. It's used as a cooking oil in the developing world, especially Indonesia, India, I think China. it's used as a biofuel in Europe and increasingly in Malaysia and Indonesia as those countries try to prop up palm oil industry by increasing their biofuel mandates, and especially also as Europe lowers its mandate because of all the environmental problems that people are now realizing are associated with these plantations. You know, there's a statistic that it's found in like half of the items on supermarket shelves. I don't know if that's true, but it speaks to the ubiquity of palm oil in our lives. And as far as how it's made, so it starts off on these plantations or farms from the oil palm tree. So they grow the oil palm tree, and then they harvest the fruit of the tree. They send it to a mill. The mill turns the fruit into crude palm oil, and then that crude palm oil is taken to a refinery where it is turned into any number of chemicals that then are used in, you know, consumer goods or biofuels or whatever it is.
Right. I heard some Dutch companies were burning the palm oil as a green biofuel, but now we know it's not really so green. I think they've cut back on that. Now, Monga Bay and the Gecko Project have just published the first of a four-part series called Indonesia for Sale. What is the title and the focus of the first piece?
The first piece is called The Palm Oil Fiefdom. In this story, we hone in on one district called Serian. This is a district in Borneo, which is Asia's second largest island. It's an island shared between Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brunei. And it's where the palm oil industry has really expanded in recent years. The article looks at the Bupati, or the district chief, whose name is Darwan Ali, and the permits he gave to oil palm plantation companies when he was in charge of the district for 10 years from 2003 to 2013. What we found is that Darwan's family and cronies set up shell companies, little no-name companies, to obtain permits from Darwan Ali, and then they immediately flipped these shell companies and the permits to major palm oil firms for a lot of money. So what it looks like is an elaborate and coordinated scheme to abuse, you know, his power as the Bupati and his power over these permits. And then what happened in the places where these companies received land, and not all of them ended up being developed, but some of them were, they caused all kinds of environmental problems, polluted the environment, grabbed people's land, destroyed the forest, fueling climate change, the story really looks at what happened when he was in charge.
Okay, so what happened to the local people, the indigenous people who lived in those areas that were just sold off to somebody, maybe a billionaire in Indonesia or a Malaysian a rich person or a corporation like, well, Pepsi or Unilever?
Sure, sure. So the companies that we looked at were sold to two multinational firms. There was the Triputra Group, which is owned by a billionaire Indonesian family, and there was Wilmar, which is owned by a Malaysian billionaire family. So the Wilmar concessions were not developed, but three of the Triputra ones were. So the people living around these company concessions, they resisted. They didn't just sit back and watch these companies take their land. In many cases, they might have protested, they might have sent letters to their local governments. And then, that didn't work because the guy who's running the district, Darwan Ali, is in league with these companies. So he didn't lift a finger to really stop them from just taking their land. So people then took direct action. They blocked company roads. Sometimes they burned down. I don't know if this happened in Serian, but it happens often in the country. They attack company offices. And what happens at that point is the company will bring in the security forces. So they'll call the riot police. Sometimes the military is around. And, these security forces typically side with the companies. And, some people try to run for local office. We talked to a guy in Serian who ran for the local parliament. Each district has a parliament. But he said, I couldn't really do anything because Darwan Ali, his party, just controlled the parliament. What ended up happening in that district was, Darwan presided over it for 10 years. And there's 2 5-year terms, and you can't run for a third term in Indonesia. There's term limits. So what he did was he tried to install his son as his successor. And, the people of Serian would just want to know part of this, and they organized against this guy, and there were these two independent candidates who ran on, a campaign squarely aimed at the palm oil industry, and they ended up winning the election. And it was the first time in that province that an independent candidate actually won Bupati's election. So it really goes to show how much these people in the district didn't want this guy's family to keep running it.
The article, The Palm Oil Fiefdom, is detailed and it names names, and I'm thinking about activist deaths in Brazil or prisons in the Philippines. I wondered how you can go back to Indonesia. Can you?
Well, I hope so. You know, Darwin Ali is just a district chief, so he's not, you know, at a higher level than that. But, you know, we do have other stories in this series, and I guess we'll just see how that goes. I worked with, you know, Indonesian journalists as well on this series. I worked with the people at the Gecko Project on this series, so it was really a team effort. And, yeah, it's something we thought about, but at the end of the day, we decided it was more important to get this story out, and that's how we'll continue to approach the stories in this series.
Well, Indonesia used to be a pretty bleak place. I was there in 1993 in Jakarta, and if Time magazine did an article about Indonesia, it was just totally blacked out, blackened on the page, if you could find a foreign publication at all. So it's really loosened up quite a bit, and I know that there are good Indonesians who are struggling to preserve that fragile democracy. I've been told, I believe by you or by someone, that the president of Indonesia has read your new article. So there may be some hope that this will help get a fairer system in the long run.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. You know, this kind of corruption over natural resources is something that was overlooked for a long time in Indonesia. The country has an anti-corruption agency. It's called the KPK, and it's the most respected institution in the country. You know, in a place where the citizens perceive their government as being so corrupt, the KPK is seen as clean. So for a long time, the KPK just went after big fish in Jakarta, right? Like ministers, you know, the leaders of political parties, that sort of thing, in the national capital, Jakarta. And, you know, it's really under-resourced as part of the reason, but it wasn't really looking at this kind of corruption out in the rural hinterlands of the country until recently. What we're seeing now is that the KPK is reviewing both coal mining permits and oil palm plantation permits on a massive scale. They're reviewing these permits for any illegalities that might be associated with them. Maybe they were issued unprocedurally. Maybe the companies aren't paying their taxes. This stuff is really, really common. So the review of coal mining permits started 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, and they've revoked like hundreds of permits. The palm oil review is now a year old, and, you know, we'll see what happens with that. It could be that they start revoking permits there too. They've also arrested a Bupati in eastern Borneo, and who's, you know, infamously known as the Queen of Coal because of how many coal mining permits she's handed out. So that was a really kind of a landmark arrest because it was the first time they'd arrested a Bupati for handing out permits without actually catching them in the act of taking a bribe. So the KPK can do that. It's just a lot harder to put together a case like that, which we examine in this article, because if you look at Darwan Ali, the Bupati of Serian, he presided over a much more complex scheme than simply, you know, you give me a bag of cash, I'll give you or your company a permit, right, using his relatives and cronies to set up shell companies, which they used as vehicles to make money from palm oil firms. Yeah, I mean, this kind of thing is, you know, Darwan is not an outlier. This kind of thing happens all over the country. The Bupati that was arrested in eastern Borneo, the Queen of Coal, you know, there's been some journalism about family connections with some of the companies that she's licensed. There's been other indications that the thing is happening in many districts. You know, the Serian is just a really egregious example, which is why we chose to focus on it for the first story in our series. But it's something that is really pervasive in the palm oil industry and really at the root of all the problems that it is singled out as causing.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Philip Jacobson, an investigative journalist and the Indonesia editor for MongaBay.com. We're talking about converting the rainforest into money, basically. Would you tell us about the environmental impacts of growing palm oil in these giant agribusiness operations?
The first thing I'll say here is that there's nothing inherently wrong with palm oil, right? It just happens to be a really profitable commodity. And so big companies are, and also smallholders, small farmers, are clearing, but mainly big companies, are clearing you know, lots of land and planting this oil palm crop on a massive scale. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that happened for hundreds of years with various different crops. It could be sugar cane. It could be beef in, you know, South America now. It's just a profitable commodity, which they want to plant on as much land as they can. As far as the environmental impacts, one of them is pollution. These companies often ignore rules that prohibit them from planting right up next to a waterway. In Serian, that was the case. And there's a lake in the heart of Serian district. It's called Lake Simbulu. And if you swim in that lake, it's itchy. I swam in it, and I came out. I was itching a little bit. So, you know, it's been polluted with all kinds of effluent from these, you know, palm oil is a really high input crop. You need a lot of fertilizer and stuff, and this kind of stuff seeps into the water system. So that's a big problem. And then you see fisheries collapse. So that's something that I've, you know, I've heard that from all kinds of communities that I've visited throughout the country is pollution of waterways. And it's not really a national issue in Indonesia, but it is something that, you know, I think will become one if these communities continue to speak up. So there's that. There's also the burning of peatlands. So Indonesia is replete with these carbon-rich peat swamps. And oil palm companies, when they ran out of land on mineral soil to plant, they turned to the peatlands. So to plant a peatland, you've got to drain the soil because it's really waterlogged. And palm oil palm trees don't do well in waterlogged soil. So what you do is you dig a trench through the soil, the water table lowers, and then you can plant it with oil palm. And it's not as good as mineral soil, but it's something. You can still run a plantation on that. But what happens is when you drain the soil of water, it gets really flammable, and it burns really easily. And peat is it's decomposing organic matter. And, you know, if you leave it there for like a million years or whatever, it often turns into coal. So you know how coal fires burn forever. Peat fires are incredibly difficult to put out. The layers of peat can stretch for meters and meters and meters below the surface so the fires can spread underground. So you've got the drainage of peatlands. And on the other hand, you've also got companies and farmers using fire to clear land for planting, which is the cheapest method. It's a lot cheaper than using a bulldozer. So, you know, you've got plenty of indigenous communities that have been doing this kind of swidden agriculture for generations, and they can actually often do it sustainably, you know, on a really small scale. But there's also all kinds of transmigrants within the country that might not know how to do it in the traditional way. You've got companies doing it illegally. And so the fires often burn out of control on these desiccated peat swamp landscapes. And so the fires in Indonesia have become such a massive issue, and they burn almost every year. 2015 was one of the worst bouts of these fires that the country has ever seen. And the emissions from these fires are just astounding. You know, for the 4 months that they burned in 2015, you know, they emitted more emissions than the entire EU economy. Indonesia is one of the leading greenhouse gas emitters, and most of its emissions come from deforestation and the burning of peatlands, you know, as opposed to the U.S. or China, where the emissions are coming from the burning of fossil fuels primarily. So that's a massive problem.
Yeah, there's the smoke. It's a health hazard for the people of Indonesia, but also it drifts all the way over to Malaysia and Southeast Asia. I've seen satellite pictures of that smoke, and it's massive.
Oh, yeah, and it goes farther than that. You know, I think the smoke in 2015 got as far as Guam and, you know, Korea, and even some people say it even got as far as Madagascar. There were traces of it.
Wow. And it's just in the news that a new species of orangutan has been discovered in Indonesia. What have you heard about that, Phil?
Yeah, that's true. I think it's called the Tapanuli orangutan, and there aren't very many left. It's in Sumatra, and yeah, it's the government is, you know, has to figure out how to protect that orangutan if they don't want it to go extinct. So we actually ran a story on that recently, both on the discovery and also on what the government plans to do about it. So it was heartening to see some environment ministry officials talk about the need to protect this orangutan. There's also been similar statements from the governor of North Sumatra province where the orangutan was discovered. So hopefully they follow through on these commitments that they're making, and the animal doesn't go extinct.
Are there protected nature areas in Borneo, and are they really protected?
There are protected areas. There's national parks, there's forest reserves, but Indonesia has a very hard time protecting these areas. You know, deforestation is continuing in these areas. Law enforcement is pretty nil. So, you know, if we think about climate change, studies are showing time and again that one of the best ways to protect an area of forest is to recognize the rights of the indigenous communities that live around that forest, that use that forest, whose culture is kind of based on that forest. There's a lot less deforestation in these kinds of areas. So there's a big indigenous peoples movement in Indonesia right now, and one of the goals of this movement is to try to secure the rights to their land. Similar things are happening in other countries, but the Indonesian movement is particularly strong. So what we saw at the beginning of this year was the president, Joko Widodo, who is known as Jokowi, he recognized the rights of nine communities to their forest lands, and you rezone these areas as what's called a customary forest area. So it's a very strong protection for these communities. And, you know, the Indigenous Peoples Alliance in Indonesia, it's an organization, is pushing for, you know, vast areas of the country to be rezoned, even as companies are also kind of competing for the same land. So, you know, the global land rush is happening all across the world, and it's, you know, it's happening in Indonesia too, and we're seeing it play out with all kinds of implications for the environment, for animals like the newly discovered Tapanuli orangutan, and for people like the people in Sarian who stood up to Darwin Ali and prevented him from installing this kind of a dynasty in the district.
So looking at this from the outside, how can we in international society help turn palm oil from a destroyer into something better?
Sure, that's a great question. So it's really interesting to think about how the international community can address these issues in a place like Indonesia. You know, there's all kinds of commitments being made by giant corporations who use palm oil. They're saying they're not going to source palm oil that's connected to deforestation, to land grabbing, to labor abuses, to other human rights abuses, or to peatland conversion. You know, in practice, all of these commitments, they all have targets that are at some point in the future, so they're still using all this kind of palm oil. What they say is they're still trying to trace their supply chains to actually figure out where their palm oil is coming from, because it's a tremendously complex supply chain, right? If you're Unilever, for example, and you're making, you know, consumer goods that we find at Walgreens or whatever it is, you know, you're buying refined chemicals from a refiner who buys palm oil from a miller who buys the palm oil from, who buys fruit from a guy with a truck, who buys that fruit from another guy with a truck, who gets it from a plantation. So, you know, they're still trying to trace out their supply chains. Nobody's been able to get past the mill level. So, you know, I don't know how effective these commitments really are at this point. I mean, they have, you know, I think it really comes down to the government of Indonesia has to, you know, prevent this stuff from happening. It really has to enforce the law. It has to create strong policies and then enforce those policies. So I think that anything the international community can do to help strengthen democracy in Indonesia is going to further those goals. And it sounds rather vague. But, you know, there's a great example from a place called Aru that I like to cite, where the international community really came to bat for a local Indonesian movement that and it helped save a large area of land from being converted into sugarcane plantations. And, you know, the people there did not want this to happen at all. But there was this giant company that was, you know, had these concessions from corrupt government officials. So what happened there was it was in a place called the Aru Islands. And this is an archipelago in eastern Indonesia, and there's all kinds of endemic species, birds of paradise there. It's a really beautiful place. Several languages are spoken by the people there. And what happened was there was this company called the Manara Group, which obtained concessions for sugarcane plantations, and these concessions covered 70% of the entire Aru archipelago. So they were essentially proposing, and more than just proposing, they were, you know, intending to go through with this plan to, you know, convert almost the entire place into sugarcane plantations. And there was a local movement that arose in opposition to this, you know, because the people there, they didn't want any part of this. And what happened was it became an international sort of a movement, especially on social media. There was this hashtag Save Aru, and you had all these different groups of people across the world, you know, lending their support to what was going on the ground. And there were all kind of protests on the ground by the people of Aru. A lot of Indonesian celebrities got involved. It started to kind of get a lot of media coverage. And there was a lot of, there was some investigating that was being done into these permits that this company held for the sugarcane plantations. And there were all kinds of problems with these permits. And it got really messy for them. And eventually the central government, the forestry ministry, allowed these concessions to expire. And the developments, you know, they didn't go ahead with these developments. So, you know, we're going to profile this in one of our stories in the series. And actually, the same company is still kind of poking around in Aru and also kind of doing a similar thing elsewhere in the country, although it's not getting as much attention. But that's one way that's just an example of how, you know, the international community really played a role in really saving the rainforest in Aru.
Do you have videos or photos about all this for our eyeballs?
We definitely do. So in addition to the print articles that we are producing as part of Manga Bay's collaboration with the Gecko Project, we also have tons of photos and short films. So these are being put out on social media, on Facebook and Instagram, on the pages of both Manga Bay and also the Gecko Project. So it's really high-quality stuff. I encourage people to go check that out. It adds to the print stories, and there's also graphics and illustrations, you know, maps and diagrams showing how these schemes work. We really thought a lot about how to communicate all this to, you know, the general reader, because it does get very, very complicated. But I do think that in the Palm Wild Fiefdom, we did a pretty good job of sort of simplifying everything in a way that people can understand. And the multimedia plays a big part in that.
As we wrap up, for those who don't know, can you briefly tell us what Manga Bay is and then what the Gecko Project is?
Sure thing. So Manga Bay is an environmental news site that's been around for like 15 years. It was started by a guy called Rhett A. Butler, no relation to the actor who was in Gone with the Wind. And he started it as his personal blog. And over the years, he eventually turned it into a nonprofit and started applying for grants and funding from foundations and donors, and turned it into a bona fide organization. So today we have 28 million readers. I think it's per year. You know, I sometimes mix up these statistics. Our outreach guy sent me a bunch of statistics, but you know, we have dozens of correspondents across the world. Four bureaus. There's Indonesia, Latin America, India now, publishing in local languages, as well as the English site, which I'm with. And I work closely with the Indonesian Bureau, which is staffed by four Indonesian editors. And also they have a network of freelance correspondents throughout Indonesia. So we're growing and growing, doing more investigative work like this. And we are collaborating with the Gecko Project, which is an initiative of the UK-based nonprofit EarthSight. And the stories that we're collaborating on, we're calling the series Indonesia for Sale. So it's been really great to collaborate with them. I think we each bring unique capabilities to the table. And it's really exciting to do this kind of work that exposes a kind of corruption that everybody in the development world in Indonesia and the people who are working on these issues like deforestation, you know, everybody kind of knows that this is going on, but it hasn't really been articulated until now. And I think we're really laying it bare with the series. So I encourage people who are interested in how corruption drives climate change to read the series.
Well, I read the first article. It's several pages. I couldn't stop. It's one of the best pieces of investigative journalism I've read in a long time, and it really took me straight into the heart of that part of Indonesia and the issues. We've been talking with Philip Jacobson. He is the Indonesia editor for the environmental group and Power News site. It's a huge, Manga Bay. They've just published the first in a blockbuster series in one of the world's biggest land grabs, the palm oil industry of Indonesia. Check it out at mangabay.com or thegeckoproject.org. Phil, thank you so much for alerting us to all this.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I hope you have left the table full and ready for action. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Now, here's a man with an important message. This is Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. Are you there? Are you there, Zafar?
Yes. Hello, Phil. I am.
Well, thank you for joining us, Zafar. There's two things I want to make sure I want to get at. One, you've been holding meetings around the burning issue of Kashmir, it's a burning issue. It's certainly for the people of Kashmir and the people of the region, but the media here is not paying attention. What can you tell us? What is the message of the meetings you've been holding?
Well, we had a meeting on Saturday, October the 28th. This essentially was to commemorate what the Kashmiri people and their friends observe as Black Day, which started basically on October 27th, 1947, the date on which India sent its army into Kashmir to occupy it illegally because the people had risen against the ruler over there. And although the people, the ruler himself was unelected, he had imposed himself on the people. The people did not want him to be their ruler. And yet he, in violation of the people's wishes, he signed an instrument of accession, or at least that is what is reported traditionally. But anyway, the people were completely unhappy with that, and so they staged an uprising on that date, and naturally the Indian army that went into Kashmir, they perpetrated a bloodbath, and the army is still there to this day. So that's the day that the people of Kashmir observe every year for the last 70 years.
Yeah, and by the way, the United Nations addressed this, saying that it should be resolved peacefully and with a referendum of the people, right?
In other
words, without the presence, by the way, of foreign armies, because you cannot vote when an army is standing on your front porch.
Exactly. In fact, you know, the people's uprising was essentially moving in a way that it was going to take over the entire state. The state is referred to as the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And it was India that took this matter to the United Nations Security Council on January the 1st, 1948. So after about 2 months, when the people had actually fought the Indian Army, and of course Pakistan's army also got involved in it because it relates to Pakistan's future as well. And India was on the verge of losing the entire state, or its army was going to be defeated, so they took the matter to the Security Council, and the Security Council passed a resolution, and there have been a series of resolutions, almost more than a dozen of them, constantly calling for a referendum to be held under the United Nations auspices. Mm-hmm. And India had agreed to it at the time, but of course, once a ceasefire came into effect and then India sent more troops into the state, today India has almost something like a million strong army and constabulary, etc., that terrorize the population in Kashmir. So mm-hmm. that region is referred to as the most militarized region in the world. Obviously, if you have a million army for a total population of about 10, 12 million people, yes. then you can imagine what is really going on. And as a consequence, of course, Indian
That's a very army, heavy repression to have an army.
Absolutely.
I mean, those numbers, you can imagine all the corollary issues you're going to have with foreigners, with soldiers. And by the way, Zafar, I noticed something seems very significant based and some of these headlines are starting to be mentioned here now about the determination to go before the Indian they are taking a case to the Indian court in which they're asking that the limitation on buying of land in Kashmir and I guess the presence of non-Kashmiris which had been protected is to be undermined, and it's. Could you talk about that? Is it Bill 34 or something? Article 34 of the Indian Constitution. Somebody wants to know.
Article 35A. There are two articles. One is Article 35A, and the other is Article 370. Under Article 370, the state of Jammu and Kashmir has been given special status under the Indian Constitution. Article 35A actually says that non-Kashmiris are not allowed to purchase land in Kashmir. Because obviously, if they did, then this would gradually change the demographic composition of Kashmir.
People are making the analogy with the West Bank.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. So what India is doing is, it is settling its retired army officers and other people in Kashmir quite surreptitiously and sort of giving them legitimacy and, of course, over a couple of generations, and these people would call themselves Kashmiris. And so India is also preparing itself for the day that suppose it was forced into holding a referendum in Kashmir, that it would have changed the composition of the state to such an extent that perhaps the majority of people would not be Kashmiris, but non-Kashmiris, but yet they would still have the right to vote. One other point it's important to keep in mind that prior to 19, or before the so-called instrument of accession of October 27, 1947, the ruler of the state had actually, first of all, disarmed all the Muslims in that region. He had ordered that they must surrender their weapons. No such order was issued to, let's say, the Hindu inhabitants. Then he went about disarming even those people that had served, the people, Muslims that were serving in the army. So he went about disarming them as well so that they would not be able to resist the ruler's wishes in the sense that he was going to, whatever nefarious designs he had. Mm-hmm. So these provisions, these actions were actually undertaken in order to prepare the ground for the ruler and the Indian army to essentially suppress the people. Mm-hmm. And so now, as you mentioned, that going about changing the demographic composition of Kashmir as well, it had happened in Jammu, where, in fact, according to the British Times, it wrote at the time that the ruler's army had actually not only perpetrated a bloodbath, but forced about 237,000 Muslims from there to flee for their lives to go into Pakistan. And ethnic cleansing, of course, a campaign of ethnic cleansing had taken place. And so now, the other ethnic cleansing process is taking place through the demographic change that, you know, people are buying land, Indians are buying land in Kashmir and trying to dilute the Kashmiri population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds actually very explosive, more so than in the past when we've spoken of this matter, particularly with this new matter with the court. Zafar, is it Crescent hyphen
online.com?
Is that right?
.net.
That's I was right. Sitting here writing, and I thought, I'm going to get it right, and I got it wrong. So it's
okay.
crescent-online.net.
That is correct. Yeah. In fact, we have a report about our latest, the conference that we held on Saturday. There is a full report in the Crescent, and of course, we have been writing about it regularly. But as you pointed out, regrettably, over here, the media doesn't pay much attention to it. Although I must say, in Britain, there is a much greater coverage of these things. Because yes. Britain created the problem, so their media yes. is paying more attention.
Yeah, and we're all going to – we'll all inherit the consequences. Zafar, thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. I want to thank Phil Conlon. Thanks, Charlotte. And we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Shireen Al-Adeimi, a graduate school student originally from Yemen, who discusses the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which the ongoing war there has triggered, and U.S. complicity with Saudi Arabia in the carnage. Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive, who assesses the career of pharmaceutical CEO Alex Azar, President Trump's nominee to become the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. And Ariel Sakwe-Deranger of the Canadian Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign, who talks about the devastating environmental, health, and climate impacts of tar sands oil extraction, where she lives in Alberta, Canada. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After Apple CEO Tim Cook was called before the U.S. Senate to explain the company's use of overseas tax havens to shelter corporate profits, Apple searched for a new tax haven when Ireland raised its corporate tax rate. 2 years ago, Apple moved its overseas subsidiaries to the English Channel island of Jersey, which does not tax corporate profits. Apple hid over $250 billion in Jersey, a crown dependency of Great Britain, which makes its own laws and isn't subject to most EU regulations. According to the Guardian newspaper, from 2014 to 2016, Apple made $122 billion in overseas profits while paying an effective tax rate of just 5.4%. The new disclosure comes from 13 million documents uncovered in the so-called Paradise Papers, which revealed how many major corporations and wealthy families use tax havens to hide profits. The documents leaked from Appleby, a Bermuda-based law firm that provides services to major corporations and the super rich, comes as congressional Republicans are moving to pass tax reform legislation which would cut the U.S. corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. A provision in the GOP tax bill would initiate a tax holiday, allowing multinational corporations to bring billions in corporate profits back to the U.S. at a sharply reduced tax rate, a proposal that critics charge encourages companies to ramp up their tax avoidance strategies in expectations of more tax holidays to come. According to the Christian Science Monitor, tens of thousands of children who were indoctrinated in ISIS schools and traumatized by watching ISIS propaganda videos in Iraq and Syria now suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, aggression, anxiety, and depression. In recent weeks, a multinational coalition of military forces have succeeded in driving ISIS out of their former strongholds in both Iraq and Syria. Therapists now working with these traumatized children say these young people have lost all hope in humanity and may be a generational time bomb of future Islamic extremists. Unfortunately, there's a severe shortage of mental health workers in the region who can provide counseling to these young ISIS recruits. According to Human Rights Watch, many former ISIS child soldiers are now held in Iraqi prisons and face harsh prison sentences. However, under growing international pressure, women and children have been allowed to leave internal refugee camps to return to villages now under the control of the Iraqi government. Still, children suspected of being loyal to ISIS continue to be held in so-called ISIS family camps. As President Trump traveled to China and Vietnam, his administration announced a new crackdown on Cuba, which halts trade deals involving Cuba's military and restricts American tourists visiting the island to group tours. The Trump administration's new rules on Cuba roll back many of President Obama's initiatives to normalize U.S.-Cuban relations. U.S. citizens and companies are now barred from dealing with dozens of Cuban businesses, including hotels, marinas, tourist agencies, and two state-owned rum distillers. In total, Americans will be barred from doing business with 180 enterprises tied to the Cuban military, intelligence, and security services. U.S. companies will be barred from investing in a new economic development zone in Mariel that Cuba envisions as crucial to its commercial future. Critics like James Williams of the group Engage Cuba condemned the restrictions, noting, quote, "The great irony in announcing these regulations on Cuba while President Trump is in communist China is dumbfounding." The White House stated that the new restrictions are not related to recent reports that U.S. diplomatic personnel in Havana have suffered serious illnesses from an alleged sonic attack from an unknown source. While Washington has not accused the Cuban government of being behind the attacks, it says the Cuban government is responsible for not protecting American diplomats while on Cuban soil and has reduced the U.S. embassy staff in Havana by 60%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The war in Yemen between Shia Houthi rebels and forces loyal to Yemen's president, Abdu Rabu Mansur Hadi, began in 2014 after rebels seized control of the capital city of Sana'a. Saudi Arabia and allied Gulf nations launched a brutal bombing campaign targeting the Houthis in March 2015. Human rights groups have condemned the nonstop Saudi airstrikes for repeatedly targeting civilians and civil infrastructure, such as schools, hospitals, and markets. It's estimated that more than 10,000 people have been killed in the conflict since 2014. However, a larger humanitarian crisis has developed due to a prolonged air and sea blockade, preventing food and medicine from entering the country. As many as 7 million people in Yemen already face famine-like conditions and rely completely on food aid to survive. An outbreak of cholera, caused by the destruction of water and sanitation systems by Saudi airstrikes, has already killed more than 2,000 people. The Saudi government grounded all humanitarian aid flights into Yemen after a missile was fired into Saudi Arabia from Yemen on November 4th. The Saudis blamed the Houthi rebels, charging that the missile was supplied by Iran, which they assert may be considered an act of war. The U.S. has aided the Saudi bombing campaign with intelligence, in-air refueling, and weapon sales. In a rare bipartisan challenge to U.S. involvement in conflicts abroad, the House of Representatives passed a resolution on November 13th, which states that U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia in its war against Yemen has not been authorized by Congress. Your reporter spoke with Shireen Al-Adimi, a Harvard graduate school student, originally from Yemen, who discusses the humanitarian crisis which the conflict has triggered, and U.S. complicity with Saudi Arabia in the ongoing war.
The Saudis have been bombing indiscriminately. They have not left anything unbombed. So houses, schools, hospitals, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, they had in 1 year, four of their hospitals were bombed. And this is after they were providing coordinates, exact coordinates to the Saudi-led coalition saying, hey, don't bomb us, we're a hospital. And that didn't seem to help either. Saudi in Yemen has been known for committing double tap strikes, which means that they bomb an area, and then when rescue operations are underway, they come and they bomb the rescuers one more time. And we've had double tap and triple tap attacks in Yemen consistently. You know, in October of last year, they bombed a funeral home, killing 140 or 150 people. And so they have crossed every boundary. Nobody has been left unscathed by their bombing campaign. And they're using, you know, the blockade as a form of control as well. They are starving people to death in Yemen. And that's another one of those violations that they continue to commit, you know, with impunity. Unfortunately, the United States has been helping them right from the beginning under the Obama administration and continuing through the Trump administration. The United States, of course, has huge weapons deals with Saudi Arabia, and so do a lot of other countries. But we go further. We provide mid-air support while the jets are flying and they're bombing civilians or targeting whatever they're targeting. The U.S. provides mid-air refueling for the Saudi jets. and they provide logistics and training and all sorts of things. And so it's really difficult to justify why we're in Yemen, and I think that's part of the reason, you know, nobody's really talking about the conflict in Yemen.
I've read that up to 7 million people in Yemen face starvation because of the air and sea blockade. And we also have a situation there where thousands of people are dying from cholera, primarily children.
The world's worst outbreak of cholera is happening in Yemen right now. Haiti, at the peak of their cholera outbreak, which took 5 years, they were at 700,000 cases. Yemen has already passed 900,000 cases in just a few months. The treatment for cholera is clean water, and people don't have clean water to drink. And so the most vulnerable are those who are very young, children and the elderly, people who have been compromised by hunger and, you know, their bodies have been weakened by starvation and whatnot. Over 2,000 have already died. The blockade means that people aren't getting food, or, you know, very little food and medicine is coming to the country. And, you know, prior to the war, Yemen used to import 90% of its food. And so there's nothing really growing in the country. We have a water crisis, and so people are starving. And whatever little food remains, people can't afford anymore because civil servants haven't been paid in a year. And those who are being paid, you know, prices have skyrocketed. The country is set to run out of fuel in 1 month and run out of vaccines in 1 month. So it's really, when the UN says this is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, it's not an exaggeration. Millions and millions of people are already at risk of starvation. People are already dying of starvation, and it's just going to get worse if the Saudis don't lift the blockade.
What can you tell us about any actions that have taken place within the U.S. Congress to address the U.S. involvement in this bloody war in Yemen, given the fact we provide intelligence, air refueling, and the sale of large amounts of weapons that are being used by the Saudis in this war?
Right. Congressman Ro Khanna from California introduced House Concurrent Resolution 81, and it says, directing the president pursuant to Section 5C of the War Powers Resolution to remove the United States Armed Forces from unauthorized facilities in the Republic of Yemen. And under the War Powers Resolution, this would have been a privileged bill, which meant that they had to vote on it and debate it in the House and then vote on this U.S. involvement in Yemen. But unfortunately, it was stripped of its privileged status. And what we learned from Ro Khanna is that he ended up negotiating an alternate resolution, which is House Resolution 599. And House Resolution 599 is non-binding. It just basically says, you know, we need to have an urgent political solution in Yemen. We denounce the activities of all parties in Yemen. It repeats a lot of the Saudi rhetoric on Iranian involvement, and it was passed in the House overwhelmingly. But this isn't the resolution that Yemenis were hoping for. This isn't the resolution that people in Yemen were hoping for that would extricate the United States from involvement in Yemen, because without the United States support, the Saudis cannot sustain this war. They rely very heavily on U.S. support in Yemen, intelligence, logistical training, all of those things, besides the weapons, of course. And so it's really disappointing that there is this one chance, there is this hope for the United States finally after 2.5 years to get out of Yemen, not be involved in these war crimes that the Saudis are committing, but nothing concrete so far.
That was Shireen Al-Adeimi, a Harvard graduate school student originally from Yemen. Learn more about the conflict in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Trump has nominated Alex Azar, a former top pharmaceutical executive, to be named Secretary of Health and Human Services. If confirmed by the U.S. Senate, Azar would replace Tom Price, who resigned as HHS Secretary in September, after it was disclosed that his questionable trips on private jets had cost taxpayers more than $1 million. Azar served as president of the Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company's U.S. division for 5 years, and prior to that was HHS General Counsel in the George W. Bush administration. Azar has condemned the Affordable Care Act, supports converting Medicaid from an entitlement program to state block grants, and opposes Obamacare's expansion of Medicaid to working families meeting income guidelines. Healthcare advocacy groups and Senate Democrats are doubtful that Azar will pursue policies to rein in the runaway price of prescription drugs, although during his campaign, Trump favored negotiations to lower drug prices. The National Nurses United Union condemned Azar's nomination, saying it's like employing a lion to herd your sheep. While Azar led Lilly USA, the company's Humalog brand of insulin more than doubled in price. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower, who's just launched a new investigative news platform called Tarbell. Here, Potter explains why he believes that Azar, if confirmed as HHS secretary, will be a disaster for millions of consumers who already are unable to afford critical prescription medicines.
Well, not only is he truly representing the pharmaceutical industry, I think he'll be representing the special interest broadly in health care. He was also serving as treasurer of this organization called the Healthcare Leadership Council, which sounds like a very useful organization and one that might have some benefit to consumers and patients. But what it is, an organization that represents the interest of pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies and big hospitals and medical device manufacturers. When I was in my old corporate job, I used to work with that organization, and it often was the place that would send out press releases, and it's based in Washington, create campaigns to benefit the industry. So bottom line here, we have an individual who is very deeply involved in his career in supporting private enterprise in the healthcare business, trying, you know, the whole reason for the existence of the Healthcare Leadership Council is to fend off any kinds of government regulation out of the fear that any kind of regulations would hinder profits. So he's very much a company man, and I just don't think that we'll see much in terms of any attention being paid to reducing the cost of medications.
What I've read about Alex Azar since his nomination by President Trump is that he is a firm opponent of any form of price controls on pharmaceutical drugs, which of course seems normal for a former CEO of one of the largest pharmaceutical companies. But Wendell, what do we know about his position on some of the proposals to constrain prices for people who really depend on these drugs to maintain their health?
What we know is that during his time at Lilly, the company increased the price of some of his medications significantly. We also know that he is on the record as saying that he thinks that rather than the government being involved to control costs, that should be done at the private level. He has suggested that insurers and pharmaceutical companies should work more closely together to do that. But my question, my response to that is, my gosh, they've had decades to do that. What does he think that is going to give them the incentive to do that now? How is he going to do that? Because the reality is that neither health insurers nor pharmaceutical companies want to make less money. And they have this game going of pointing the finger of blame away from themselves and toward the other, but they have a very symbiotic relationship. So it's just foolishness to think that the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry would ever do anything to bring costs down. In fact, they worked very cooperatively. They did work very cooperatively, as a matter of fact, when the Congress was considering the Medicare prescription drug benefit. And it was written by lobbyists for insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. So in that sense, they did collaborate, and that with members of Congress. And as a part of that, Medicare was prohibited from negotiating for lower prices. So the insurers and the pharmaceutical companies got a very sweet deal out of that, but not so much the taxpayers.
Wendell, you understand the games that go on in Washington, and I'm wondering, as you look at the nomination process for Alex Azar to be the next Secretary of Health and Human Services, what are the prospects that you think he can be effectively challenged, at least by the Democrats within the Senate?
Well, I think they really do need to challenge him and find out what he actually proposes to do about high drug costs and what his strategy would be, or at least what he would do as a, a leader of that department, which, of course, includes the Medicare and Medicaid programs. What are his plans for those programs? And would he continue to resist efforts to give Medicare the ability to have lower cost? What's he going to do in many different areas that pertain to the Affordable Care Act? He's spoken very negatively of that law, which does certainly have its flaws, but has been a lifesaver for many people, has brought so many people into coverage. So there are a lot of questions that I think members of both parties should be asking, but Democrats in particular should be very concerned about what he likely would do with regards to both jurisdiction over pharmaceutical companies and the price of drugs, as well as the Affordable Care Act.
That was Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and author, who's just launched a new investigative news platform, tarbell.org. Find more commentary on Alex Azar's nomination to be the next Health and Human Services Secretary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Just before the United Nations convened COP23 in Bonn, Germany, the 23rd Conference of Parties to discuss and reach agreement to take action to halt climate change, the American Public Health Association launched its annual conference in Atlanta on November 4th. The theme of the five-day gathering this year was climate change and health, which was attended by some 12,000 public health professionals and students, mostly from the U.S., but also from 40 other nations. The conference keynote speaker was Ariel Sakwe-Duranger, a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation of northern Alberta, Canada. She's a leader in the Indigenous Environmental Network Canadian Tar Sands campaign, which is working to stop construction of four different pipelines that would carry tar sands, the dirtiest, most energy-intensive oil on the planet, from Alberta to the U.S., other parts of Canada, and beyond. Duranger talked about the terrible health and climate impacts on her people due to fossil fuel contamination and the move away from traditional hunting and trapping to consumption of processed foods. Health consequences, she said, include lower life expectancies, increased levels of obesity, diabetes linked to diet, respiratory diseases caused by the drivers of climate change, and increased cancer rates. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the American Public Health Association conference, where she recorded and produced this excerpt of Duranger's talk.
The land is the very essence of who we are. It nurtures our bodies, our minds, our cultures, and our connection to our role on this planet Earth, Mother Earth. I want my children to know what it means to be Dene. I want this picture and these experiences of mine not to be relics of the past, but something to be celebrated by future generations. But that is all being threatened right now because of global climate change. Humanity is facing a global crisis, climate change. Indigenous people are not only threatened by the colonial ideologies and policies to eradicate our civil and human rights, but our very cultures and our identities are threatened by man-made climate change, precipitated by colonial ideologies rooted in things like capitalism. We're witnessing coastlines rising, floods, out-of-control forest fires, and species disappearing, changing weather patterns. And it's these impacts that are being disproportionately felt by communities least responsible for climate change and those that are most vulnerable in society, like communities like my own. But right now, my people's lands and territories is under threat from the largest industrial project on planet Earth, the Alberta oil sands. This is not your sweet conventional crude oil. It's thicker, like peanut butter, and at room temperature, when it's extracted from the ground, is almost as hard as a rock. It has a relatively higher concentration of nitrogen, sulfur, and heavy metals, and it's the pace and scale of this development that makes it out of control. 10% of the world's oil reserves exist in my people's traditional territory. 10%. Over 96% of Canada's total oil reserves are contained within the traditional territories of the Dene, the Cree, and the Métis people. Currently, over 900 square kilometers of land have been disturbed for tar sands mining. Over 4,000 square kilometers have been leased out to projects right now. Currently, the industry uses 170 billion liters, not million, billion liters of water, fresh water, every single year, and this is only expected to increase. This fresh water ends up in toxic tailings ponds that now cover 260 square kilometers of land, held in place with some of the world's largest earthen dams. And every day, these toxic tailings leach into our river systems, contaminating our water systems, contaminating our foods. However, mining is not even the only accessible method. The other 80%, because 20% is mining, is in situ. And in situ is similar to fracking, in so much that you steam and you put pressure into the ground. And in this case, we're superheating fresh water and diluents or solvents at high pressure, injecting them into the ground to melt the bitumen so that underlying pipelines can suck it back up and ship it off to refineries. In the end, in-situ operations require more energy and generate 2.5 times as much greenhouse gas per barrel than mining operations. These projects now represent 31% more emissions than the average conventional crude oil. And they're the fastest single-growing emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada. They create more emissions than all the cars on the road combined in the country, Canada, not the United States. And they stand as a barrier for us meeting our climate commitments. More than ever, we need to move towards decolonizing not just the environment, but decolonizing our solutions. Indigenous peoples are exercising our sovereign rights to implement our own environmental and health infrastructures, to regulate and enforce our own laws within our lands and territories, as defined by the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Articles 3 and 10. We are our own experts. We are doctors, biologists, scientists, educators, and we have the fundamental right to exist and build our own systems in partnership with our settler partners.
That was Arielle Sekwe Deranger of the Canadian Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Introduction.
Does the title of this work seem provocative? If so, then good. That's how it's intended to be. For if the question is provocative, then what of the answer? Is not the answer, no matter how damning, far more provocative? And yet, who dares answer in any way other than the negative? There is an old axiom, especially among journalists and journalism professors, that today's newspapers are the first draft of history. Like most axioms, they hold a kernel of truth, but there is more. Here is another axiom. History is written by the victors. The words that follow on these pages were not written by a victor, but by one who has seen and sensed what was happening on the other side of a prison wall, who seeks to convey those impressions with truth, and who has often done so several times a week. In a sense, the impressions recorded in these pages ahead are a form of history, Black history, recorded during a particular passage of time. During this particular period, we experienced the greatest economic disaster since the Great Depression of the 1930s. The cultural dominance of hip-hop, the nation's fever over mass incarceration, the Obama presidency, the spread of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the unexpected onset of the Donald J. Trump era. True history, what Howard Zinn called the people's history, is the one which gives us voices of ordinary people and create, through these words, their ordinary struggles. And yet for Blacks, much that never makes it to the newspapers, or if so, only in a distorted form, still leaves scars in the mind, evidence of trauma sustained from simply existing as a Black person in the United States of America. The pages ahead reflect the people's struggles in the invisible sectors of American society. Sectors which, by a terrible necessity, are populated largely by Blacks, Latinos, immigrants, the incarcerated, and those with little income. The pages ahead are also, by equal necessity, reflections of insurgent, emergent, radical, and revolutionary aspiration, thinking, and living. For from oppression comes solidarity, resistance, rebellion, and change. National movements like Black Lives Matter are manifestations of such solidarity and resistance and give voice to the eruption of outrage, angst, hopes, and insurgent protest provoked by each new killing. That such a movement was brought into being by three young women of color, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, and Alicia Garza, is telling, for throughout American history, we have seen how the dedicated efforts of women of color have driven resistance networks and liberation movements. These determined sisters have both studied history and altered it, and continue to do so today. You've been listening to the opening words, an introduction to the book, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? This is its author, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I am here not just to read these words, but to thank you for coming to this party, to greet you, all of you, old, young, straight, gay, Black, Latino, brown, yellow, of every color, of every character, of every age, of every gender, for daring to join me here tonight, at least in spirit. I thank you. I welcome you. And believe it or not, I love you, each and every one of you, for being part of this day and this movement. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal saying, I love you all. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
True motives behind the assassination of President John F. Kennedy? How are U.S. intelligence agencies implicated in the grooming of supposed lone gunman Lee Harvey Oswald and in the Kennedy shooting? Were there any significant revelations coming out of Kennedy files released from the National Archives? Why do so many government critics seem hesitant to embrace the notion that U.S. government would and has carried out conspiracies like the Kennedy assassination and 9/11. On this week's Global Research News Hour, in the lead-up to the 54th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, we consider what is known about that event and its relevance today. We'll speak with the author of a seminal work on the subject of the assassination, James W. Douglas. We'll hear from ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern about the recent release of documents on the assassination. And we'll hear from scholar and professor of economics Paul Zaremka about left denial surrounding state crimes against democracy in general. On this week's program, the plot against Kennedy, why it matters in the era of Trump. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 17th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The situation with North Korea is terrifying. I see the stealthy buildup of pressure on the Security Council, similar to that preceding the Iraq and Libya invasions. The Russian-China veto prevented an attack by the UN on Syria, but Russia and China are not vetoing these vicious sanctions on North Korea and permitting this incredibly provocative US ROK military surrounding the DPRK. What deals are being made? On October 13th, the DPRK sent another emergency letter to the United Nations Secretary General Guterres. This was the third letter sent to the UN since November 20th, three letters in 23 days attempting to alert the United Nations to the crisis situation in Northeast Asia, jeopardizing international peace and security, a crisis that could precipitate nuclear war at any moment. All three letters have been ignored, raising alarming questions about the UN's commitment to save humanity from the scourge of war. That comes from the article, "The Situation in North Korea is Terrifying. U.S. ROK Military Threats are Provocations for Nuclear War," by Carla Stea, posted November 15th. The East Ghouta's terrorists are exploiting a sense of empathy of the international community. They don't want to get UN and Assad's humanitarian aid. Instead, they prevent any aid to be delivered into the Damascus district. to arouse the storm of indignation from all over the world with the aim to break the siege, they draw the pictures of starving and exhausted children. So the Western real goal is to force the Syrian Arab army to stop the siege so that the terrorists could regroup. That comes from the article, Syria, Media Disinformation Campaign Blaming Assad for Alleged Famine in Terrorist-Held East Ghouta, Fake Accounts, Photos, by Sophie Mangal, posted November 14th, originally appearing at Inside Syria Media Center. Israel has instructed its overseas embassies to lobby their respective host countries in support of Saudi Arabia and its apparent efforts to destabilize Lebanon, a recently leaked diplomatic cable shows. The cable appears to be the first formal confirmation of rumors that Israel and Saudi Arabia are colluding to stoke tensions in the region. Sent by the Israeli Foreign Ministry and disclosed by Israel's Channel 10 News this week, the cable demanded that diplomats stress Iran and Hezbollah's engagement in regional subversion. That closely echoes accusations Riyadh leveled against Tehran and the Lebanese faction in recent days. Analysts have noted that diplomatic moves by Israel to intervene directly in a seemingly internal Arab matter are, quote-unquote, very rare. That comes from the article, Saudi-Israeli Collusion? Is Israel Seeking Role as Leader of the Sunni Bloc? By Jonathan Cook, posted November 14th, originally appearing at jonathancook.net. Annual reports from the MOD's internal watchdog, the Defense Nuclear Safety Regulator, or DNSR, have been abruptly classified as secret. Published for the last 10 years, the reports have repeatedly warned of the dangers of spending cutbacks, staff shortages, and accidents. But now, the MOD says that the reports will be kept under wraps in the interests of, quote-unquote, national security. This has prompted a tirade of accusations that it is trying to hide embarrassing concerns about nuclear safety and avoid public scrutiny. DNSR annual reports since 2006 have been released by the MOD after an early challenge under Freedom of Information Law. That comes from the article, Trident Nuclear Safety Reports Suppressed by British Ministry of Defense, by Rob Edwards, posted November 14th, originally appearing at heraldscotland.com. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Published in 2008, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, is acclaimed by many prominent analysts as one of the seminal texts on the subject of the Kennedy assassination. The author is James Douglas. James W. Douglas is a longtime peace activist and writer. Together with his wife, Shelley, he's co-founder of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Poulsbo, Washington, and Mary's House, a Catholic worker house of hospitality in Birmingham, Alabama. His works include The Nonviolent Cross, The Nonviolent Coming of God, Resistance and Contemplation, and most recently, Gandhi and the Unspeakable. He joins us now from his home in Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome to the program, James Douglas.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Now, in the premise of your book, you identify the influential American Catholic mystic, writer, and Trappist monk Thomas Merton as providing guidance in your investigation of the JFK assassination. What unique and important perspective does Thomas Merton bring to an overall understanding of this subject?
Well, first of all, I had the gift of knowing Thomas Merton. I used to visit him at the Abbey of Gethsemane, where in the hills of Kentucky, he had, I believe, a deeper understanding of what was going on during President Kennedy's time in office than practically anyone inside what they call the Beltway of Washington. He had eyes that were formed by contemplative prayer, to be quite explicit, in a very profound way that enabled him to see what I couldn't see in those days when I was visiting him, nearly anything remotely like he could. And that even today, I think we have to learn from him. He saw things in terms especially of the unspeakable. He wrote a great book called Raids on the Unspeakable. And from his contemplative perspective, he was able to see things like the Holocaust, the nuclear arms race, the racism that was and is destroying this country and many other countries. He saw them as a depth of systemic evil that defied speech. And in his book, Raids on the Speakable, he called it a void. He said the unspeakable is the void that contradicts everything that is spoken, even before the words are said, the void that gets into the language of public and official declarations at the very moment when they are pronounced. Think of the Warren report, which was being written just at about the time that he said those words, wrote those words, and makes those words ring dead with the hollowness of the abyss. The unspeakable is the void out of which Eichmann drew the punctilious exactitude of his obedience. So from the standpoint of this book, it's the void out of which people executed John F. Kennedy for becoming a peacemaker as President of the United States.
And in terms of becoming a peacemaker, I mean, you argue JFK went through a transformation during the last 3 years of his life. He was essentially going from a functionary within this violent and brutal state apparatus to a man of peace, and,
yes,
and the need to – and so there was a need to contain – Mr. Kennedy's turn away from that military-industrial complex. I mean, that was essentially, you know, the motive behind the assassination. So
it was indeed.
So what were those critical turning points? I mean, there were a number that you list.
Well, one of the first was the Bay of Pigs invasion, which Kennedy was manipulated into and lied to by the CIA. He was told that the brigade, the Cuban exile brigade that had been trained during the Eisenhower administration by the CIA and was being deployed in to overthrow Castro, he was told that they would be supported by the bulk of the Cuban people. Total lie. And he was told also by his intelligence agencies, with the CIA leading the pack, that the landing would take place in an area where the brigade could become guerrillas if they were not successful immediately on their beach landing. Well, there wasn't any area where they could become guerrillas. I mean, it wasn't. The whole terrain was totally different from what he had been led to believe. And he was just manipulated by the CIA. And the whole point, as Alan Dulles confessed in a very quiet way in a manuscript that never appeared anywhere, the whole point was to put Kennedy into a position where, in order to win over against the Castro government, he would have to call in the entire force of the U.S. military and engage in a total invasion of Cuba, which he had said even before he reluctantly agreed to the Bay of Pigs he would never do, and he held his line. And he said very specifically after the Bay of Pigs, "I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds," which was cited in the New York Times after he was assassinated, and not put into any context as to the reason for his assassination. Then, of course, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which Kennedy was largely responsible in many ways for almost incinerating the world, along with Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro, all of them for, quote, good reasons. They all had, in the conflict over the missiles being put into Cuba by Khrushchev in support of Castro to stop Kennedy, from stopping the CIA in its further efforts to overthrow Cuba, all of them, quote, had good reasons, but it was terrible for the entire world and terrible for the countries of each of their governments. And Kennedy, in the midst of all this, turned, and I use the word in the biblical sense, metanoia, shuva, repentance, turning. He turned toward his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, at the most bottoming out part of the missile crisis, when Kennedy was losing control of his own government because the military were so pushing so hard to invade Cuba and were actually trying to antagonize the Soviet Union in such a way that they could justify an invasion of Cuba. At that point, Kennedy sent Robert, his brother, the Attorney General, to Anatoly Dobrynin, the ambassador in Washington, and appealed to Khrushchev to pull the missiles out of Cuba, and Kennedy would agree to pull his out of Turkey and would pledge publicly never, ever to invade Cuba, nor would his government ever invade Cuba. And at that point, Kennedy was beyond the pale in terms of embracing Khrushchev in a way that Kennedy was closer to Khrushchev than he was to his own national security state. And Khrushchev, in turn, in responding to that appeal and saying to his foreign minister, we have to help Kennedy. We now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war. At that point, those two men turned to each other in such a way that one would be assassinated by his own government, Kennedy in the USA, and the other, Khrushchev, overthrown by his own government, the USSR. And that's that key one. But to choose just one other one, in his American University address, June 10, 1963, John F. Kennedy called publicly for an end to the Cold War in a speech that Khrushchev called the greatest speech any U.S. president has made since Roosevelt. And from that point on, they were working closely together. They signed a nuclear test ban treaty together. Kennedy began a back-channel dialogue with Fidel Castro to normalize U.S.-Cuban relations. And he issued National Security Action Memorandum 263 to withdraw U.S. troops from Vietnam. And at the very moment that he was being assassinated in Dallas, his unofficial representative, Jean Daniel, a reporter from Paris, was meeting with Fidel Castro in a beginning dialogue between Kennedy and Castro at the very moment he was assassinated in Dallas.
So we end up with that motive to take him out, and we see one shadowy figure in the person of Lee Harvey Oswald, who is being identified as the single lone guy, lone gunman, lone nut, whatever you want to call him. But of course, there's a pattern of involvement which you outline and others have outlined that indicate that he's had long-standing connections with U.S. intelligence agencies, CIA, FBI, going way, way back. Step by step, moving forward.
Yes.
To through New Orleans,
yes.
So I'm wondering if you could just maybe address that point, maybe some of the most salient points with regard to that specific figure.
Lee Harvey Oswald was working with the CIA from the time he was a U.S. Marine. He was a radar operator with top secret clearance at Atsugi Air Force Base. The CIA base in Japan, at the time that the U-2s, which he was responsible for tracking, he was a key guy as a Marine at Atsugi Air Force Base. He tracked the U-2s when they crossed the Soviet Union or China. And when he was discharged from the service under a very questionable, bogus reason, he was within weeks over in Moscow stating that he wanted to declare his allegiance to the Soviet Union. And then he stayed there for a couple of years. And he was being monitored and encouraged all that time by the CIA, and especially by James Jesus Angleton, the head of the CIA counterintelligence. This is all in the documents and sources that I used in the book. So it's the key counterintelligence person in the Central Intelligence Agency who's the guideline for and the guide for Lee Harvey Oswald's movements in the Soviet Union when he's a so-called, actually a fake defector to the Soviet Union. So his whole background is preparing him once he's back in the United States and once Kennedy begins to make these turns for a role in the assassination. And through the summer and fall of 1963, he's prepared for that in both New Orleans and in Mexico in ways that he himself doesn't understand. He's part of the plot, but he thinks he's part of the plot in a completely different way than being the scapegoat. And there's a prior plot in Chicago, which is totally analogous in planning to prepare to kill President Kennedy to what actually happens in Dallas, where another man named Thomas Arthur Valley, who was like Oswald, a CIA-connected ex-Marine currently employed in a building overlooking a parade route for President Kennedy on November 2, 1963, 3 weeks before his assassination. Everything is exactly the same, but there's a whistleblower. And the whistleblower, perhaps not coincidentally, is named Lee. I think the whistleblower was, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald, and that he prevented Kennedy being killed in Chicago and then himself became the scapegoat in Dallas. He was, in fact, if that's true, that's just based on some strong suggestions in what happens in Chicago. If that's true, then Oswald was a hero in Chicago and a scapegoat in Dallas.
And, of course, in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald got shot, and as they say, dead men can tell no tales. Interesting coincidence.
He got shot 2 days after he said to reporters publicly, and it's on tape and it's in videos, "I'm just a patsy." He shouted that out as he was being led through the courthouse. And you can hear it yourself if you Google the right stuff on YouTube or somewhere.
Yeah. There was, in Dallas itself, there is a figure by the name of Ed Hoffman who brings an interesting dimension.
Wonderful man, Ed Hoffman.
Yeah, somebody who's a deaf-mute.
Yeah.
And so he was able to observe some suspicious activities in the area of the grassy knoll.
That's right.
And is in particular two suspicious figures, the suit man and the railroad man. Basically, so you want to maybe just outline some of those, the points that came out forward from Mr. Hoffman that should really deserve attention.
Ed Hoffman, of course, because in 1963, a person who was a deaf mute did not have the ways that one has half a century later to communicate with people. Deaf mutes were basically shunned or confined to an area where they couldn't get out their testimony. So he was standing on a bridge and looking with a perspective behind the grassy knoll. So he, in the time before the motorcade came, that he had gone to this bridge to observe from a dental appointment. He went to look down in the area behind the grassy knoll, but especially to see the president come by and come under his bridge. He watched this one man prepared with a rifle to shoot the president, and he raised the rifle. And as soon as the limousine had passed by and the president was hit by the man's shot, he couldn't hear the shot. He could just see the rifle being raised and something happening to the president. And then the man turned quickly and threw his rifle to another man who put it in a bag. The second man was dressed like a railroad operator. The first man had on a suit. And then they quickly moved in directions where they could be taken out of the area. He just observed all of this behind, from a perspective behind the grassy knoll. And then he tried to get it out for days, months, years, and both because of his difficulty in communicating, and secondly, because his relatives, one of whom was in the police department in a key way, they all discouraged him. Don't, because they knew that if he got it out effectively, it would be very bad news for him personally. It's a great, great story, and it's one of the many witness stories that I told in the book about people who raised questions that, like President Kennedy, risked their lives, and some of their lives were actually taken, not Ed Elfman's.
Mm-hmm. And that does kind of speak to another point, and I think we just about have to round it up, but moving forward to 2017, that there is a lesson for us in an age of the war on terror, 9/11, and we're seeing these same forces in play, that the story of the assassination and ensuing cover-up of JFK, it's something that almost like a parable. It speaks to the actions of individual citizens today, not the least of whom you might think a particular president by the name of Trump. So I'm wondering if you'd like to maybe help bridge the realities of the how the realities, the cover-up, the collective denial, how that can speak to people today, and how we can act, how we could perhaps model our behavior on the transformation that JFK underwent.
Well, it's almost impossible to understand the pressures that Kennedy was under. I've had to work on it for a long time to begin to get into that kind of understanding. And the intelligence agencies today and the military-industrial complex and the entire apparatus of the United States government and its allies is based on the same power that Kennedy resisted from the center of it. But as Martin Luther King and Malcolm X resisted from the outside, whose assassinations I'm working on also, and Robert Kennedy resisted like his brother from the inside. All four of them went down to that. And if anybody today stands up in as powerful and effective a way as those four people did, we can expect the same. And we ought to feel good about it, because people all over the world are struggling against those forces. And whether that it's Trump or somebody else in power, it's exactly the same forces that took down Kennedy. If you can take down a Kennedy, you're going to immobilize any other president and terrorize him, including Trump, who's surrendered entirely to his generals at this point. So Trump is not unique. We're the ones who are unique, and we have the power through nonviolent resistance to turn as even a president of the United States could and did, and we can transform this situation. If he could do it from the most unlikely place in the world, the Oval Office of the White House, we can do it.
James Douglas, I'm really honored to have had you on the program, and I want to thank you for sharing these insights with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Michael, and peace be with everybody out there, and let's all take our own steps toward the kind of nonviolent transformation that can change our world.
We've been joined by James Douglas. He is the author of the 2008 book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And he joined us from Birmingham, Alabama. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. A number of documents relating to the Kennedy assassination were scheduled to be released this year from the U.S. National Archives in accordance with the JFK Assassination Records Collection Act. In spite of President Trump's assurances he wouldn't hold back the scheduled releases, the FBI and CIA have been successful in delaying the releases of hundreds of documents on the grounds of national security to help us discern what is and is not in those documents. And the overall significance and relevance to the broader story, we're joined once again by Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst with a 27-year record with the agency. He's co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Ray.
Thank you, Michael.
I should point out that on October 30th at Consortium News published an article of yours with the provocative title, The Deep State's JFK Triumph Over Trump. And since you that article was published, there have been two major releases. I'm wondering if anything has come out in these the first 2 weeks of November that's caused you to change your thoughts about this release of documents, if there's anything significant there that people should be paying attention to.
There's a simple answer to that, Michael, and that's no.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all, no. They're very selective. You know, the mind boggles at the fact that so long after the assassination and so long after Congress decreed that these documents should be released, the CIA and the FBI still insist that several not be released, not even in redacted form, and even more important, the President of the United States bows to that kind of pressure. So for those who think that the deep state is some kind of construct by conspiracy theorists, it's real. And for Trump to be in the embarrassing position in the morning to have promised full release of all these documents as required by law, and then in the afternoon, oops, sorry, we're going to give the FBI and CIA, we'll give another 6 months to finish the job of picking out what's to be released. And we're still going to hide the names and other data. So hang on, folks. 6 months, we'll get it all right.
There have been some comments about, for example, some revelations in some of the commentary around, for example, Oswald's dealings in Mexico. And there was some this idea that someone who was not Oswald was masquerading as him, and there's been some I guess you might say revelations, but I'm not sure that there's been very much that wasn't already known in that regard.
Well, a lot of the documents had already been released; others are still redacted. But the bottom line, Michael, is that this is a very complicated, very detailed, and I'll use the word, conspiracy. Now, if people want to sort through it, and it takes attention, okay? There's a great book out. It's been out for 7 or 8 years now. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable. It's by a fellow named James Douglas. I know him well. He has integrity to just don't quit. Now, he spent about a decade going through everything that had been published before, including the documents already released by congressional edict. And his answer is, yes, there is copious evidence, if you put it all together, that the CIA and the FBI were involved in this thing, even parts of the Secret Service and other, well, the military, of course, who hated Kennedy and feared that he was soft on communism. It's just that, you know, the thing reads like a detective story. I mean, it's an easy read, but you have to pay attention to it. And, this is indicative, Michael. Mm-hmm. No one reviewed the book. Okay? No one. So, what do you make out of that?
Yeah. And, we did have a chance to talk to him as well, so that there's that broader picture has already been painted. But I know that in terms of the way these intelligence forces operate, I mean, there's always that official story. The official story, you know, trumpeted by mainstream sources is that Oswald was the lone gunman. But then there's, you know, what my understanding is that in releases of this kind, there's always a kind of like a backup story in case people stop believing the lone gunman theory. They'll have a backup story. And do you see these releases as somehow playing into that strategy?
No, they're just being fed to the public as though they added something to the story, but they're carefully crafted and carefully redacted and carefully excluded to disguise the whole story. Now, what's different here and what's really interesting and important is that Trump is taken on or has taken on the deep state big time, okay? Now, the big state, which includes the very cooperative mainstream media, have painted this story that Trump really owes his election to Vladimir Putin. Get that, okay? Well, the steady drumbeat has gone on almost forever, for a year, okay? Now, what has Trump done? He's taken him on. He said, I don't believe that. I don't believe my own intelligence people. As he said that, okay, so what does that mean? Well, that means that he's acted in a way that John Kennedy did, and in other words, refusing to bow to the power of the intelligence agencies, and he's been warned specifically about this. Now, was this some oddball on the media? No, this was a senator who was the Democratic leader in the Senate, who has spent 18 years in the House, 18 plus years in the Senate. His name is Chuck Schumer. And on 3 January of this year, he warned Rachel Maddow, the big star on our talk television. He says, look, Donald Trump is taking on, this is words, quote, taking on the intelligence community. More from Schumer, quote, let me tell you, Rachel, you take on the intelligence community, they have 6 ways from Sunday getting back at you. So for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, Trump is being really dumb to do this. Well, he's done it. Now, it's going to be really interesting to see if he can spirit out of the CIA evidence, I mean, like real evidence, that the Russians interfered with our election. Because in my view and the view of much more technically apt people who work with us and veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, it's all what we call in the Bronx a crock. It's all invented. There is no tangible evidence that the Russians did this, and particularly the celebrated hack of the Democratic National Committee can be proven from forensic evidence. Okay, forensic evidence like the principle of fluid dynamics, which is, you know, physics. Physics doesn't lie. That hack was not a hack. It was a copy onto a external storage device. On the 5th of July, represented as a hack by the insertion of Cyrillic, by the insertion of a MS Word type format known to be Russian. The whole thing was contrived. And if Trump takes this on, as he gives some evidence of doing, this is really interesting. Trump instructed the head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, to have our principal scientific analysts from our veteran intelligence professionals for sanity visit Pompeo and brief him for a whole hour on the 24th of October. Whoa. Now, what would he do that if he grieved his own people? And why would Pompeo, Mr. President, you know, that's a really nice gesture, but here, the evidence is solid. We don't need to talk to Bill Binney, for God's sake. He has a whole different story, and he supports it with forensic evidence, but we don't need to talk. And here's the evidence. If you make me talk to Bill Binney, my troops are going to be really, really upset. Now, why didn't Pompeo act that way? Because he doesn't have any evidence either. And he was happy to talk to Bill Binney. They talked for an hour. And what comes of that is going to be really interesting. But that's already, 3 weeks ago. And the things that Pompeo suggested that Bill Binney do, namely talk to the heads of the FBI and the NSA, well, Bill has not been contacted by either of those. And his last encounter with the FBI was with gun-drawn people poking revolvers into his shower when they raided his home for no good reason, because he wasn't charged with anything. And that happened in 2007. So Bill has not had a happy experience with the FBI, but they haven't called him. They're not interested. They're part of the deep state.
And just maybe finally, because it sounds like we're seeing the deep state attempting the same thing they tried to do with JFK, and it just tried to box him in to their agenda, and the president is fighting back. Does Trump have any options at this point other than acquiescence?
Well, theoretically, yes. But he also knows about JFK. Yeah? I mean, his predecessor, Obama, not large, about 12 people, big fundraisers, right? Big money people, at a dinner for Obama many years ago. They were progressives, and they said, why are you not acting like a progressive? And he stood up, and he said, look, I'm getting tired of this. Don't you remember what happened to Dr. King? Now, he didn't say John Kennedy, but Dr. King perished the same way, and that's proven in a court of law that the parts of the military, the rednecks down there, there were lots of proof that that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and it was a government conspiracy. Now, when I use the word conspiracy, there's a slander that has been used for everything, including 9/11, and that is you don't want to be branded a, quote, conspiracy theorist, period, end quote. I've looked into that, Michael. Guess where that originated? That originated with Alan Dulles, the CIA director, who got himself appointed to pretty much direct the Warren Commission looking into the assassination of JFK. And when people started saying, well, wait a second now, some people suspect that the CIA might have been involved, what did Alan Dulles say? He's a conspiracy theorist. It's a very convenient way to demean or to dismiss people who are only trying to get at the truth, like Bill Binney and like myself.
And it's worked, unfortunately, it's worked very well, it seems.
we're banned from the media. What I would like to point out is that when they're forcing RT, Russia Today, to register as a foreign agent, well, the distinctive thing about RT, in my experience, is that unlike CBS, ABC, CNN, Al Jazeera, BBC, they don't give me a, quote, pre-interview, end quote, which means that they don't have the producer say, Ms. Mullen, what do you say about this? What's your take on it? Like, before the interview itself. Now, that is a common practice. And BBC, for example, has interviewed me for 15 minutes and said, well, we really don't need you tonight. We have somebody else. So there you go. Now, RT has never done that. And I'm a regular on RT. And I'm happy to do that because a lot of Americans now are aware that they get the straight scoop, at least for me and others, on RT, and they have access to it there, where they don't have access to it in what used to be a pretty big rag, namely the New York Times, which used to print, actually, almost everything that was fit to print. No more is that the case.
Well, you certainly have access to the Global Research NewsHour, and I want to thank you very much for joining us, Ray McGovern.
You're most welcome, Michael.
We've been joined by Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Serious researchers of the Kennedy assassination and other state crimes against democracy have encountered an aversion by members of the general public to entertaining dissident perspectives. This includes those who identify themselves as progressive, left-wing, and even outright critical of government policy. One academic who has probed this phenomenon is Paul Zaremka. Paul Zaremka is a professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He edited the 2006 volume, The Hidden History of 9/11, and in 2015 authored a paper, A Challenge to Geopolitical Economy, September 11th, and Conspiracy Theory, which argues that the resistance to exploring dissident perspectives on 9/11 is anti-intellectual and that there is a strong basis for alleging state complicity in high crimes historically. Global Research NewsHour managed to get hold of Professor Zaremka while he was visiting Winnipeg for the Geopolitical Economy Research Group's 2017 Revolutions Conference.
I think that part of the resistance of Marxists to conspiracy theory about something like September 11th is that September 11th shows the state in a very bad light. I think there is a certain part of Marxism for which the government itself is important. They want, for example, government-run healthcare, this and that. Okay, if you get too, I think this is a subtext. This is not conscious. I think that they don't want to go too far with criticizing the state because it can bounce back to the idea of a state-run economy. You follow what I mean? Okay. So my guess is that, and it's kind of a hypothesis, people who get more interested in state planning under socialism would probably be more resistant for that reason to hearing very negative. In other words, it's not, their perception is more or less a transformation, rather than an overthrow of the state. Okay, so I guess there must be something to do there with a different perception of what the revolution is about.
That's interesting, because it seems to me that, when people start looking at some of these problems with the official story of 9/11, and they go to the net to try to find other resources, that there seems to be a preponderance of sites that articulate a more libertarian right wing, and they don't have a problem with shooting down the state.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. The resistance of some Marxists that I'm talking about is, they don't want to go there. They don't want to go to that extreme. But from my own, I'm just saying it from my own point of view, I always thought that the state was a state for the capitalist class. So why don't we deal with it straight up? Like, okay, don't give it any credit that it's not due. I mean, if it's something is happening, investigate. I still don't know exactly who did what. I'm just saying that one should go below the surface, and there's very deep and very negative things going on below the surface of society, and that's my basic position.
Okay. Well, it's been 16 years since the 9/11 attacks. It's been almost 54 years since the Kennedy assassination, when we're seeing a lot more growth and suspicion of what the things that the state is doing sort of behind the scenes. Can you look at maybe some more recent developments, you know, maybe even over the last couple of years, where you see new turns in the direction of the this whole meme of questioning what the state is doing, the conspiracy investigations and the willingness of the public to embrace them?
I don't know.
Okay.
My feeling is that not that much is changing. I try to remind people moving away from Kennedy right now, but actually for the Martin Luther King case, there's even much more dramatic case, and that is that they had a trial in 1999 that convicted the government of being partially involved in a conspiracy against to kill Martin Luther King. I mean, it was a normal quote trial of a jury trial where the jury convicted co-conspirators, and it's amazing how many people don't even know that, don't even know that it took place, and that's because the mainstream media doesn't even talk about it. Okay, they talk about Simpson's case all over the place. Okay. But what that trial was more important than Simpson, by far more important than Simpson's trial, but they don't talk about it. And yet, isn't that what our system was about? I mean, our judicial system, isn't that about if you go to trial of something like this and you find a conviction? Well, that's supposed to say something. It's supposed to say something very big, and it's ignored. Okay. So I meet even very well-informed people that don't know that trial in 1999 took place. Kennedy's thing is more well-known because we had the movie, you know, the JFK movie, and it made a huge difference in terms of knowledge that what happened to Kennedy was not what was. What the government says. But nevertheless, you still read in the newspapers today, if you pick up a New York Times today, you pick up my own local newspaper, Buffalo News, you won't see even a hint that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald that killed Kennedy. You won't even see a hint of it. It'll either say it directly, the killer of Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, as if there's no issue about it. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, you get this over and over and over again, repeated as if it's fact.
Speaking about fact, right now, in the last several months, there's been a narrative about Russia interfering in the U.S. elections of 2016. And it seems like almost a flip side phenomenon, because that idea has largely been discredited by people like William Binney and veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. And yet there's no actual evidence that I'm aware of that this took place. This is what would be referred to as a conspiracy theory. And yet this is something that's being embraced when there's far more convincing evidence of U.S. Government officials orchestrating the 9/11 attacks. Yeah. So I wonder if you wanted to, you know, maybe comment on what that reality speaks to you.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I haven't seen any evidence. I don't even know why we're talking about Russia interfering with U.S. election. Why don't we talk about whether the Clinton administration interfered with Bernie Sanders' election or not? I mean, there's a lot of evidence that there was a lot of fraud committed.
I mean, I think that there has been a lot of distrust in mainstream media that's grown since the time of the 9/11 attacks. That's my general impression. And so I think that was probably a factor in the U.S. presidential elections.
Yes.
So what are some of the hazards now in an era where the general public doesn't believe the mainstream media, but they do manage to reach out to, you know, whatever, media sources, independent media sources generally reinforce their own perspectives?
When I give one of my classes at the university, I present the Martin Luther King trial case. And I ask students, I'm hoping it that students understand it as there is truth, but it's not always not readily transparent. You have to dig down. Okay, that's the way I present it. Okay, not a long discussion. I'm talking about 10 minutes of class. We have other things to do, but I'm just trying to do that for the students. Okay, so and then I ask an exam question, and only some of them realize that I'm not encouraging them to think that there is not truth. A lot of them think kind of in a Trump way, even though they don't even, they may hate Trump, but they think that it just depends upon who you're talking to, that there is no objective truth here. It's kind of like there's your truth, there's my truth, there's Trump's truth, and, you know, that kind of thing. And that's terrible. I mean, we can't have that. Okay, we have to defend the fact that there is reality to deal with, but at the same time, it made me a little bit concerned. I'm concerned that deep down people believe too often. They believe what something in themselves wants to believe, and not want to face the reality. And there's a lot of that, okay? I don't know how to overcome it. Maybe it's just part of modern world, I don't know. I don't have a good answer.
Looking ahead to this avalanche of information that's been opened up by the internet, what do you see coming? Are we going to develop the skills to overcome?
No, but now we, if you're talking about the internet now, I was just in Germany, and a law took effect yesterday, October 1st. And the law says, as I understand it, the law says that social media firms which allow, quote, something like fake news to appear on among any of their users opens the social media provider to liability and heavy fines, not minor fines, heavy fines. And that raises not only the issue of the potential, and what's going to be happening is the prosecution of people who are, yeah, the possible prosecution of the individuals, but even more importantly, the prosecution of the, or the fear of, let's say, Twitter or whatever. I mean, I don't know who, anybody, to even allow that kind of material to be on their site, because if they don't take it down within, I think it's 2 hours or something, in a very short period of time, they can be subject to the fines.
So it creates a chill effect.
Yeah, that's what I'm really concerned about, a chill effect. So let's just take an example of September 11th. I mean, could it not be the case that that if September 11th becomes something that they want to erase from discussion, the Germans are taking the first step to be able to do that, to be able to erase it. Now, that we're a long way from that completely happening, because there's still going to be independent sites and so forth and so on. But to even go down that road of state control of what is going to be on the internet is a heavy problem. And we're starting down that road. I think in England they're doing it also, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm not sure exactly what the laws are.
Sort of like the 21st century equivalent of book burning.
Yes. Right. Correct. Right.
Well, ominous, yeah, outlook. But Paul Zaremka, I really appreciate being able to speak with you this way. I've appreciated your work, and I hope look forward. Maybe we can have conversations in the future, maybe with better news.
Thanks very much, Michael.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.